Close up, not 5 steps away, she could see much more about their appearance, but her attention was held by something lively and aware in their gaze, by an intelligence. These creatures were as different from the grazing animals nearby as a human was from a cow. Mary pointed to herself and said,
"Mary."
The nearest creature reached forward with its trunk. She moved closer and it touched her on the breast, where she had pointed, and she heard her voice coming back to her from the creature's throat.
"Mary, what are you?"
she said.
"What are you?"
the creature responded.
"I am a human,"
she said.
"I am a human,"
said the creature, and then something even odder happened. The creatures laughed. Their eyes wrinkled, their trunks waved, they tossed their heads, and from their throats came the unmistakable sound of merriment. She couldn't help it. She laughed too. Then another creature moved forward and touched her hand with its trunk. Mary offered her other hand as well to its soft, bristled, questing touch.
"Oh, you're smelling the oil from the seed pod."
"Seed pod," said the creature.
"If you can make the sounds of my language, we might be able to communicate one day. God knows how. Mary,"
she said, pointing to herself again. Nothing. They watched. She did it again.
"Mary."
The nearest creature touched its own breast with its trunk and spoke. Was it 3 syllables or 2? The creature spoke again, and this time Mary tried hard to make the same sounds.
"Mulefa,"
she said tentatively. Others repeated,
"Mulefa,"
in her voice, laughing, and even seemed to be teasing the creature who had spoken.
"Mulefa,"
they said again, as if it were a fine joke.
"Well, if you can laugh, I don't suppose you'll eat me,"
Mary said. And from that moment there was an ease and friendliness between her and them, and she felt nervous no more. And the group itself relaxed. They had things to do, they weren't roaming at random. Mary saw that one of them had a saddle or pack on its back, and 2 others lifted the seed pod onto it, making it secure by tying straps around it, with deft and intricate movements of their trunks. When they stood still, they balanced with their lateral legs, and when they moved, they turned both front and back legs to steer. Their movements were full of grace and power. One of them wheeled to the edge of the road and raised its trunk to utter a trumpeting call. The herd of grazers all looked up as one and began to trot towards them. When they arrived, they stood patiently at the verge and let the wheeled creatures move slowly through them, checking, touching, counting. Then Mary saw one reach beneath a grazer and milk it with her trunk, and then the wheeled one rolled over to her and raised her trunk delicately to Mary's mouth. At first she flinched, but there was an expectation in the creature's eye, so she came forward again and opened her lips. The creature expressed a little of the sweet, thin milk into her mouth, watched her swallow, and gave her some more again and again. The gesture was so clever and kindly that Mary impulsively put her arms around the creature's head and kissed her, smelling the hot, dusty hide and feeling the hard bones underneath and the muscular power of the trunk. Presently the leader trumpeted softly and the grazers moved away. The Mulefa were preparing to leave. She felt joy that they had welcomed her and sadness that they were leaving, but then she felt surprise as well. One of the creatures was lowering itself, kneeling down on the road and gesturing with its trunk, and the others were beckoning and inviting her. No doubt about it, they were offering to carry her, to take her with them. Another took her rucksack and fastened it to the saddle of a third, and awkwardly Mary climbed onto the back of the kneeling one, wondering where to put her legs, in front of the creatures or behind, and what could she hold on to? But before she could wake it out, the creature had risen, and the group began to move away along the highway, with Mary riding among them.
"Because he's Will."
Chapter 8. Vodka.
I have been a stranger in a strange land. The Book of Exodus.
Balthamos felt the death of Baruch the moment it happened. He cried aloud and soared into the night air over the tundra, flailing his wings and sobbing his anguish into the clouds. And it was some time before he could compose himself and go back to Will, who was wide awake, knife in hand, peering up into the damp and chilly murk. They were back in Lyra's world.
"What is it?"
said Will as the angel appeared, trembling beside him.
"Is it danger? Get behind me."
"Baruch is dead. My dear Baruch is dead."
"When? Where?"
But Balthamos couldn't tell. He only knew that half his heart had been extinguished. He couldn't keep still. He flew up again, scouring the sky as if to seek out Baruch in this cloud or that, calling, crying, calling. And then he'd be overcome with guilt and fly down to urge Will to hide and keep quiet, and promise to watch over him tirelessly. And then the pressure of his grief would crush him to the ground, and he'd remember every instance of kindness and courage that Baruch had ever shown, and there were thousands, and he'd forgotten none of them. And he'd cry that a nature so gracious could never be snuffed out, and he'd soar into the skies again, casting about in every direction, reckless and wild and stricken, cursing the very air, the clouds, the stars. Finally Will said,
"Balthamos, come here."
The angel came at his command, helpless. Shivering inside his cloak, in the bitter cold gloom of the tundra, the boy said to him,
"You must try to keep quiet now. You know there are things out there that'll attack if they hear a noise. I can protect you with the knife if you're nearby, but if they attack you up there, I won't be able to help. And if you die too, that'll be the end for me. Balthamos, I need you to help guide me to Lyra. Please don't forget that. Baruch was strong. Be strong too. Be like him for me."
At first Balthamos didn't speak, but then he said,
"Yes, yes, of course I must. Sleep now, Will, and I shall stand guard. I shan't fail you."
Will trusted him. He had to, and presently he fell asleep again. When he woke up, soaked with dew and cold to his bones, the angel was standing nearby. The sun was just rising, and the reeds and the marsh plants were all tipped with gold. Before Will could move, Balthamos said,
"I've decided what I must do. I shall stay with you, day and night, and do it cheerfully and willingly, for the sake of Baruch. I shall guide you to Lyra, if I can, and then I shall guide you both to Lord Ezreal. I have lived thousands of years, and unless I am killed, I shall live many thousands of years more. But I never met a nature that made me so ardent to do good, or to be kind, as Baruch's did. I failed so many times, but each time his goodness was there to redeem me. Now it's not. I shall have to try without it. Perhaps I shall fail from time to time, but I shall try all the same."
"Then Baruch would be proud of you,"
said Will, shivering.
"Shall I fly ahead now and see where we are?"
"Yes. Fly high and tell me what the land's like further on. Walking on this marshland is going to take forever."
Balthamos took to the air. He hadn't told Will everything he was anxious about because he was trying to do his best and not worry him. But he knew that the angel Metatron, the regent, from whom they'd escaped so narrowly, would have Will's face firmly imprinted on his mind. And not only his face, but everything about him that angels were able to see, including parts of which Will himself was not aware, such as that aspect of his nature Lyra would have called his demon. Will was in great danger from Metatron now, and at some time Balthamos would have to tell him. But not quite yet. It was too difficult. Will, reckoning that it would be quicker to get warm by walking than by gathering fuel and waiting for a fire to catch, simply slung the rucksack over his shoulders, wrapped the cloak around everything, and set off towards the south. There was a path, muddy and rutted and potholed, so people did sometimes come this way, but the flat horizon was so far away on every side that he had little sense of making progress. Sometime later, when the light was brighter, Balthamos's voice spoke beside him.
"About half a day's walk ahead, there is a wide river and a town where there's a wharf for boats to tie up. I flew high enough to see that the river goes a long way directly south and north. If you could get a passage, then you could move much more quickly."
"Good. And does this path go to the town?"
"It goes through a village with a church and farms and orchards and then on to the town."
"I wonder what language they speak. I hope they don't lock me up if I can't speak theirs."
"As your demon, I shall translate for you. I have learned many human languages. I can certainly understand the one they speak in this country.
Will walked on. The toil was dull and mechanical, but at least he was moving, and at least every step took him closer to Lyra. The village was a shabby place, a huddle of wooden buildings with paddocks containing reindeer, and dogs that barked as he approached. Smoke crept out of the tin chimneys and hung low over the shingled roofs. The ground was heavy and dragged at his feet, and there had obviously been a recent flood. Walls were marked with mud to halfway up the doors, and broken beams of wood and loose hanging sheets of corrugated iron showed where sheds and verandas and outbuildings had been swept away. But that was not the most curious feature of the place. At first he thought he was losing his balance. It even made him stumble once or twice, for the buildings were 2 or 3 degrees out of the vertical, all leaning the same way. The dome of the little church had cracked badly. Had there been an earthquake? Dogs were barking with hysterical fury, but not daring to come close. Balthamos, being a demon, had taken the form of a large, snow-white dog with black eyes, thick fur, and tight-curled tail, and he snarled so fiercely that the real dogs kept their distance. They were thin and mangy, and the few reindeer Will could see were scabby-coated and listless. Will paused in the centre of the little village and looked around, wondering where to go, and as he stood there, 2 or 3 men appeared ahead and stood staring at him. They were the first people he had ever seen in Lyra's world. They wore heavy felt coats, muddy boots, and fur hats, and they didn't look friendly. The white dog changed into a sparrow and flew to Will's shoulder. No one blinked an eye at this. Each of the men had a demon, Will saw, dogs most of them, and that was how things happened in this world. On his shoulder, Balthamos whispered,
"Keep moving. Don't look them in the eye. Keep your head down. That is the respectful thing to do."
Will kept walking. He could make himself inconspicuous. It was his greatest talent. By the time he got to them, the men had already lost interest in him. But then a door opened in the biggest house in the road, and a voice called something loudly. Balthamos said softly,
"The priest. You will have to be polite to him. Turn and bow."
Will did so. The priest was an immense grey-bearded man wearing a black cassock with a crow demon on his shoulder. His restless eyes moved over Will's face and body, taking everything in. He beckoned. Will went to the doorway and bowed again. The priest said something, and Balthamos murmured,
"He's asking where you come from. Say whatever you like."
"I speak English. I don't know any other languages."
"Ah, English,"
cried the priest gleefully in English.
"My dear young man, welcome to our village. Our little no longer perpendicular Holodnoye. What is your name? And where are you going?"
"My name is Will, and I'm going south. I have lost my family, and I'm trying to find them again."
"Then you must come inside and have some refreshment,"
said the priest, and put a heavy arm around Will's shoulders, pulling him in through the doorway. The man's crow demon was showing a vivid interest in Balthamos, but the angel was equal to that. He became a mouse and crept into Will's shirt as if he were shy. The priest led him into a parlour, heavy with tobacco smoke, where a cast-iron samovar steamed quietly on a side table.
"What was your name? Tell me again."
"Will Parry, but I don't know what to call you."
"Otyets Semyon,"
said the priest, stroking Will's arm as he guided him to a chair.
"Otyets means father. I'm a priest of the Holy Church. My given name is Semyon, and the name of my father was Boris, so I am Semyon Borisovich. What is your father's name?"
"John Parry."
"John is Ivan, so you are Will Ivanovich, and I am Father Semyon Borisovich. Where have you come from, Will Ivanovich, and where are you going?"
"I'm lost. I was travelling with my family to the south. My father is a soldier, but he was exploring in the Arctic, and then something happened and we got lost. So I'm travelling south because I know that's where we were going next."
The priest spread his hands and said,
"A soldier? An explorer from England? No one so interesting as that has trodden the dirty roads of Holodnoye for centuries. But in this time of upheaval, how can we know that he will not appear tomorrow? You yourself are a welcome visitor, Will Ivanovich. You must stay the night in my house, and we will talk and eat together. Lydia Alexandrovna,
he called. An elderly woman came in silently. He spoke to her in Russian, and she nodded and took a glass and filled it with hot tea from the samovar. She brought the glass of tea to Will, together with a little saucer of jam with a silver spoon.
Thank you.
The conserve is to sweeten the tea. Lydia Alexandrovna made it from bilberries.
The result was that the tea was sickly as well as bitter, but Will sipped it nonetheless. The priest kept leaning forward to look closely at him, and felt his hands to see whether he was cold, and stroked his knee. In order to distract him, Will asked why the buildings in the village sloped.
There has been a convulsion in the earth,
the priest said.
It is all foretold in the Apocalypse of St. John. Rivers flow backward. The great river, only a short way from here, used to flow north into the Arctic Ocean. All the way from the mountains of Central Asia it flowed north, for thousands and thousands of years, ever since the authority of God, the Almighty Father, created the earth. But when the earth shook, and the fog and the floods came, everything changed. And then the great river flowed south for a week or more, before it turned again and went north. The world is turned upside down. Where were you when the great convulsion came?
A long way from here. I didn't know what was happening. When the fog cleared, I had lost my family, and I don't know where I am now. You've told me the name of this place, but where is it? Where are we?
Bring me that large book on the bottom shelf. I will show you.
The priest drew his chair up to the table and licked his fingers before turning the pages of the great atlas.
Here,
he said, pointing with a dirty fingernail at a spot in central Siberia, a long way east of the Urals. The river nearby flowed, as the priest had said, from the northern part of the mountains in Tibet all the way to the Arctic. He looked closely at the Himalaya, but he could see nothing like the map Baruch had sketched. Semyon Borisovich talked and talked, pressing Will for details of his life, his family, his home, and Will, a practiced dissembler, answered him fully enough. Presently the housekeeper brought in some beetroot soup and dark bread, and after the priest had said a long grace, they ate.
Well, how shall we pass our day, Will Ivanovich? Shall we play at cards? Or would you prefer to talk?
He drew another glass of tea from the samovar, and Will took it doubtfully.
I can't play cards, and I'm anxious to get on and keep travelling. If I went to the river, for example, do you think I could find a passage on a steamer going south?
The priest's huge face darkened, and he crossed himself with a delicate flick of the wrist.
There is trouble in the town. Lydia Alexandrovna has a sister who came here and told her there is a boat carrying bears up the river. Armored bears. They come from the Arctic. You did not see armored bears when you were in the north?
The priest was suspicious, and Balthamos whispered so quietly that only Will could hear,
Be careful.
And Will knew at once why he'd said it. His heart had begun to pound when Semyon Borisovich mentioned the bears because of what Lyra had told him about them. He must try to contain his feelings.
We were a long way from Svalbard, and the bears were occupied with their own affairs.
Yes, that is what I heard,
said the priest, to Will's relief.
But now they're leaving their homeland and coming south. They have a boat, and the people of the town will not let them refuel. They are afraid of the bears, and so they should be. They are children of the devil. All things from the north are devilish, like the witches. Daughters of evil. The church should have put them all to death many years ago. Witches have nothing to do with them, Will Ivanovich. You hear me? You know what they will do when you come to the right age? They will try to seduce you. They will use all the soft, cunning, deceitful ways they have. Their flesh, their soft skin, their sweet voices. And they will take your seed. You know what I mean by that? They will drain you and leave you hollow. They will take your future, your children that are to come, and leave you nothing. They should be put to death, everyone.
The priest reached across to the shelf beside his chair and took down a bottle and two small glasses.
Now I am going to offer you a little drink, Will Ivanovich. You are young, so not very many glasses. But you are growing, and so you need to know some things, like the taste of vodka. Lydia Alexandrovna collected the berries last year, and I distilled the liquor. And here in the bottle is the result, the only place where not yet Semyon Borisovich and Lydia Alexandrovna lie together.
He uncorked the bottle, filling each glass to the rim. This kind of talk made Will hideously uneasy. What should he do? How could he refuse to drink without discourtesy?
Odyet Semyon,
he said, standing.
You have been very kind, and I wish I could stay longer to taste your drink and to hear you talk, because what you tell me has been very interesting. But you understand I am unhappy about my family and very anxious to find them again, so I think I must move on, much as I would like to stay.
The priest pushed out his lips in the thicket of his beard and frowned. But then he shrugged.
Well, you shall go if you must. But before you leave, you must drink your vodka. Stand with me now. Take it and down all in one. Like this.
He threw back the glass, swallowing it all at once, and then hauled his massive body up and stood very close to Will. In his fat, dirty fingers, the glass he held out seemed tiny, but it was brimming with the clear spirit, and Will could smell the heady tang of the drink and the stale sweat and the food stains on the man's cassock, and he felt sick before he began.
Drink, Will Ivanovich!
The priest cried with a threatening heartiness. Will lifted the glass and unhesitatingly swallowed the fiery, oily liquid in one gulp. Now he would have to fight hard to avoid being sick. There was one more ordeal to come. Semyon Borisovich leaned forward from his great height and took Will by both shoulders.
My boy,
he said, and then closed his eyes and began to intone a prayer or a psalm. Vapors of tobacco and alcohol and sweat came powerfully from him, and he was close enough for his thick beard wagging up and down to brush Will's face. Will held his breath. The priest's hands moved behind Will's shoulders, and then Semyon Borisovich was hugging him tightly and kissing his cheeks, right, left, right again. Will felt Balthamos dig tiny claws into his shoulder and kept still. His head was swimming, his stomach lurching, but he didn't move. Finally it was over, and the priest stepped back and pushed him away.
Go, then! Go south, Will Ivanovich! Go!
Will gathered his cloak and the rucksack and tried to walk straight as he left the priest's house and took the road out of the village. He walked for 2 hours, feeling the nausea gradually subside and a slow, pounding headache take its place. Balthamos made him stop at one point and laid his cool hands on Will's neck and forehead, and the ache eased a little. But Will made himself a promise that he would never drink vodka again. And in the late afternoon the path widened and came out of the reeds, and Will saw the town ahead of him, and beyond it an expanse of water so broad it might have been a sea. Even from some way off, Will could see that there was trouble. Puffs of smoke were erupting from beyond the roofs, followed a few seconds later by the boom of a gun.
Balthamos, you'll have to be a demon again. Just keep near me and watch out for danger.
He walked into the outskirts of the scruffy little town, where the buildings leaned even more perilously than the village, and where the flooding had left its mud stains on the walls high above Will's head. The edge of the town was deserted, but as he made his way towards the river, the noise of shouting, of screams, and of the crackle of rifle fire got louder. And here at last there were people, some watching from upper floor windows, some craning anxiously around the corners of buildings to look ahead at the waterfront, where the metal fingers of cranes and derricks and the masts of big vessels rose above the rooftops. An explosion shook the walls, and glass fell out of a nearby window. People drew back and then peered around again, and more cries rose into the smoky air. Will reached the corner of the street and looked along the waterfront. When the smoke and dust cleared a little, he saw one rusting vessel standing offshore, keeping its place against the flow of the river, and on the wharf a mob of people armed with rifles or pistols surrounding a great gun, which, as he watched, boomed again. A flash of fire, a lurching recoil, and near the vessel a mighty splash. Will shaded his eyes. There were figures in the boat, but he rubbed his eyes, even though he knew what to expect. They weren't human. They were huge beings of metal, or creatures in heavy armour, and on the foredeck of the vessel a bright flower of flame suddenly bloomed, and the people cried out in alarm. The flame sped into the air, rising higher and coming closer and shedding sparks and smoke, and then fell with a great splash of fire near the gun. Men cried and scattered, and some ran in flames to the water's edge and plunged in, to be swept along and out of sight in the current. Will found a man close by who looked like a teacher, and said,
"Do you speak English?"
"Yes, yes, indeed."
"What is happening?"
"The bears. They are attacking, and we try to fight them, but it is difficult. We have only one gun, and..."
The fire-thrower on the boat hurled another gout of blazing pitch, and this time it landed even closer to the gun. Three big explosions almost immediately afterwards showed that it had found the ammunition, and the gunners leapt away, letting the barrel swing down low.
"Ah, it's no good. They can't fire."
The commander of the boat brought the vessel's head around and moved in towards the shore. Many people cried out in alarm and despair, especially when another great bulb of flame burst into being on the foredeck, and some of those with rifles fired a shot or two and turned to flee. But this time the bears didn't launch the fire, and soon the vessel moved broadside on towards the wharf, engine beating hard to hold it against the current. Two sailors, human, not bears, leapt down to throw ropes around the bollards, and a great hiss and cry of anger rose from the townsfolk at these human traitors. The sailors took no notice, but ran to lower a gangplank. Then, as they turned to go back on board, a shot was fired from somewhere near Will, and one of the sailors fell. His demon, a seagull, vanished as if she'd been pinched out of existence like a candle flame. The reaction from the bears was pure fury. At once the fire-thrower was relit and hauled around to face the shore, and the mass of flame shot upwards and then cascaded in 100 spilling gouts over the rooftops. And at the top of the gangway appeared a bear larger than any of the others, an apparition of iron-clad might, and the bullets that rained on him whined and clanged and thudded uselessly, unable to make the slightest dent in his massive armour. Will said to the man beside him,
"Why are they attacking the town?"
"They want fuel, but we have no dealings with bears. Now they are leaving their kingdom and sailing up the river. Who knows what they will do? So we must fight them. Pirates! Robbers!"
The great bear had come down the gangway, and massed behind him were several others, so heavy that the ship listed. And Will saw that the men on the wharf had gone back to the gun and were loading a shell into the breach. An idea came, and he ran out onto the quayside, right into the empty space between the gunners and the bear.
"Stop! Stop fighting! Let me speak to the bear."
There was a sudden lull, and everyone stood still, astonished at this crazy behaviour. The bear himself, who had been gathering his strength to charge the gunners, stayed where he was, but every line of his body trembled with ferocity. His great claws dug into the ground, and his black eyes glowed with rage under the iron helmet.
"What are you? What do you want?"
he roared in English, since Will had spoken in that language. The people watching looked at one another in bewilderment, and those who could understand translated for the others.
"I'll fight you in single combat, and if you give way, then the fighting has to stop."
The bear didn't move. As for the people, as soon as they understood what Will was saying, they shouted and jeered and hooted with mocking laughter. But not for long, because Will turned to face the crowd and stood cold-eyed, contained, and perfectly still until the laughter stopped. He could feel the blackbird Balthamos trembling on his shoulder. When the people were silent, he called out,
"If I make the bear give way, you must agree to sell them fuel. Then they'll go on along the river and leave you alone. You must agree. If you don't, they'll destroy all of you."
He knew that the huge bear was only a few yards behind him, but he didn't turn. He watched the townspeople talking, gesticulating, arguing, and after a minute, a voice called,
"Boy! Make the bear agree!"
Will turned back. He swallowed hard and took a deep breath and called,
"Bear, you must agree. If you give way to me, the fighting has to stop, and you can buy fuel and go peacefully up the river."
"Impossible! It would be shameful to fight you. You are as weak as an oyster out of its shell. I cannot fight you."
"I agree,"
said Will, and every scrap of his attention was now focused on this great ferocious being in front of him.
"It's not a fair contest at all. You have all that armour and I have none. You could take off my head with one sweep of your paw. Make it fairer, then. Give me one piece of your armour, any one you like, your helmet, for example. Then we'll be better matched, and it will be no shame to fight me."
With a snarl that expressed hatred, rage and scorn, the bear reached up with a great claw and unhooked the chain that held his helmet in place. And now there was a deep hush over the whole waterfront. No one spoke. No one moved. They could tell that something was happening such as they'd never seen before, and they couldn't tell what it was. The only sound now was the splashing of the river against the wooden pilings, the beat of the ship's engine, and the restless crying of seagulls overhead, and then the great clang as the bear hurled his helmet down at Will's feet. Will put his rucksack down and hoisted the helmet up on its end. He could barely lift it. It consisted of a single sheet of iron, dark and dented, with eye holes on top and a massive chain underneath. It was as long as Will's forearm and as thick as his thumb.
So this is your armour? Well, it doesn't look very strong to me. I don't know if I can trust it. Let me see.
And he took the knife from the rucksack and rested the edge against the front of the helmet and sliced off a corner as if he were cutting butter.
That's what I thought,
he said, and cut another and another, reducing the massive thing to a pile of fragments in less than a minute. He stood up and held out a handful.
That was your armour,
he said, and dropped the pieces with a clatter onto the rest at his feet.
And this is my knife. And since your helmet was no good to me, I'll have to fight without it. Are you ready, Bear? I think we're well matched. I could take off your head with one sweep of my knife, after all.
Utter stillness. The bear's black eyes glowed like pitch, and Will felt a drop of sweat trickle down his spine. Then the bear's head moved. He shook it and took a step backwards.
Too strong a weapon. I can't fight that. Boy, you win.
Will knew that a second later the people would cheer and hoot and whistle, so even before the bear had finished saying the word win, Will had begun to turn and call out to keep them quiet.
Now you must keep the bargain. Look after the wounded people and start repairing the buildings. Then let the boat tie up and refuel.
He knew that it would take a minute to translate that and let the message spread out among the watching townsfolk, and he knew, too, that the delay would prevent their relief and anger from bursting out as a net of sandbanks baffles and breaks up the flow of a river. The bear watched and saw what he was doing and why, and understood more fully than Will himself did what the boy had achieved. Will put the knife back in the rucksack, and he and the bear exchanged another glance, but a different kind this time. They approached, and behind them, as the bears began to dismantle their fire thrower, the other two ships maneuvered their way to the quayside. On shore, some of the people set about clearing up, but several more came crowding to see Will, curious about this boy and the power he had to command the bear. It was time for Will to become inconspicuous again. So he performed the magic that had deflected all kinds of curiosity away from his mother and kept them safe for years. Of course, it wasn't magic, but simply a way of behaving. He made himself quiet and dull-eyed and slow, and in under a minute he became less interesting, less attractive to human attention. The people simply became bored with this dull child and forgot him and turned away. But the bear's attention was not human, and he could see what was happening, and he knew it was yet another extraordinary power at Will's command. He came close and spoke quietly, in a voice that seemed to throb as deeply as the ship's engines.
What is your name?
Will Parry. Can you make another helmet?
Yes. What do you seek?
You're going up the river. I want to come with you. I'm going to the mountains, and this is the quickest way. Will you take me?
Yes. I want to see that knife.
I will only show it to a bear I can trust. There is one bear I've heard of who's trustworthy. He is the king of the bears, a good friend of the girl I'm going to the mountains to find. Her name is Lyra Silvertongue. The bear is called Yorick Birnison.
I am Yorick Birnison.
I know you are.
The boat was taking fuel on board. The rail cars were hauled alongside and tilted sideways to let coal thunder down the chutes into the hold, and the black dust rose high above them. Unnoticed by the townspeople, who were busy sweeping up glass and haggling over the price of the fuel, Will followed the Bear King up the gangway and aboard the ship. Chapter 9. Upriver.
A shade upon the mind there passes, as when on noon a cloud the mighty sun encloses. Emily Dickinson.
Let me see the knife,
said Yorick Birnison.
I understand metal. Nothing made of iron or steel is a mystery to a bear. But I have never seen a knife like yours, and I would be glad to look at it closely.
Will and the Bear King were on the foredeck of the river steamer, in the warm rays of the setting sun, and the vessel was making swift progress upstream. There was plenty of fuel on board, there was food that Will could eat, and he and Yorick Birnison were taking their second measure of each other. They had taken the first already. Will held out the knife towards Yorick, handle first, and the bear took it from him delicately. His thumb claw opposed the four finger claws, letting him manipulate objects as skillfully as a human, and now he turned the knife this way and that, bringing it closely to his eyes, holding it to catch the light, testing the edge, the steel edge, on a piece of scrap iron.
This edge is the one you cut my armor with. The other is very strange. I cannot tell what it is, what it will do, how it was made. But I want to understand it. How did you come to possess it?
Will told him most of what had happened, leaving out only what concerned him alone. His mother, the man he killed, his father.
You fought for this and lost two fingers. Show me the wound.
Will held out his hand. Thanks to his father's ointment, the raw surfaces were healing well, but they were still very tender. The bear sniffed at them.
Blood moss, and something else I cannot identify. Who gave you that?
A man who told me what I should do with the knife. Then he died. He had some ointment in a horn box, and it cured my wound. The witches tried, but their spell didn't work.
And what did he tell you to do with the knife?
Said Yorick Birnison, handing it carefully back to Will.
To use it in a war on the side of Lord Asriel. But first I must rescue Lyra Silvertongue.
Then we shall help,
said the bear, and Will's heart leapt with pleasure. Over the next few days, Will learned why the bears were making this voyage into Central Asia, so far from their homeland. Since the catastrophe that had burst the worlds open, all the Arctic ice had begun to melt, and new and strange currents appeared in the water. Since the bears depended on ice and on the creatures who lived in the cold sea, they could see that they would soon starve if they stayed where they were, and being rational, they decided how they should respond. They would have to migrate to where there was snow and ice in plenty. They would go to the highest mountains, to the range that touched the sky, half a world away but unshakable, eternal, and deep in snow. From bears of the sea they would become bears of the mountains, for as long as it took the world to settle itself again.
So you're not making war?
Will said.
Our old enemies vanished with the seals and the walruses. If we meet new ones, we know how to fight.
I thought there was a great war coming that would involve everyone. Which side would you fight for in that case?
The side that gave advantage to the bears. What else? But I have some regard for a few among humans. One was a man who flew a balloon. He is dead. The other is the witch Seraphina Pecola. The third is the child Lyra Silvertongue. First, I would do whatever serves the bears. Second, whatever serves the child or the witch, or avenges my dead comrade Lee Scoresby. That is why I will help you rescue Lyra Silvertongue from the abominable woman Coulter.
He told Will of how he and a few of his subjects had swum to the river mouth and paid for the charter of this vessel with gold, and hired the crew, and turned the draining of the Arctic to their own advantage by letting the river take them as far inland as it could. And as it had its source in the northern foothills of the very mountains they sought, and as Lyra was imprisoned there too, things had fallen out well so far. So time went past. During the day Will dozed on deck, resting, gathering strength, because he was exhausted in every part of his being. He watched as the scenery began to change, and the rolling steppe gave way to low grassy hills and then to higher land, with the occasional gorge or cataract, and still the boat steamed south. He talked to the captain and the crew, out of politeness, but lacking Lyra's instant ease with strangers, he found it difficult to think of much to say, and in any case they were little interested in him. This was only a job, and when it was over they would leave without a backward glance, and besides, they didn't much like the bears, for all their gold. Will was a foreigner, and as long as he paid for his food, they cared little what he did. Besides, there was that strange demon of his which seemed so like a witch's. Sometimes it was there, and sometimes it seemed to have vanished. Superstitious, like many sailors, they were happy to leave him alone. Balthamos, for his part, kept quiet, too. Sometimes his grief would become too strong for him to put up with, and he'd leave the boat and fly high among the clouds, searching for any patch of light or taste of air, any shooting stars or pressure ridges that might remind him of experiences he had shared with Baruch. When he talked, at night in the dark of the little cabin Will slept in, it was only to report on how far they had gone, and how much further ahead the cave and the valley lay. Perhaps he thought Will had little sympathy, though if he'd sought it he would have found plenty. He became more and more curt and formal, though never sarcastic. He kept that promise, at least. As for Yorick, he examined the knife obsessively. He looked at it for hours, testing both edges, flexing it, holding it up to the light, touching it with his tongue, sniffing it, and even listening to the sound the air made as it flowed over the surface. Will had no fear for the knife, because Yorick was clearly a craftsman of the highest accomplishment, nor for Yorick himself, because of the delicacy of movement in those mighty paws. Finally, Yorick came to Will and said,
"This other edge, it does something you have not told me about. What is it? And how does it work?"
"I can't show you here because the boat is moving. As soon as we stop, I'll show you."
"I can think of it, but not understand what I am thinking. It is the strangest thing I have ever seen."
And he gave it back to Will, with a disconcerting, unreadable long stare out of his deep black eyes. The river by this time had changed colour, because it was meeting the remains of the first floodwaters that had swept down out of the Arctic. The convulsions had affected the earth differently in different places, Will saw. Village after village stood up to its roofs in water, and hundreds of dispossessed people tried to salvage what they could with rowboats and canoes. The earth must have sunk a little here, because the river broadened and slowed, and it was hard for the skipper to trace his true course through the wide and turbid streams. The air was hotter and the sun higher in the sky, and the bears found it hard to keep cool. Some of them swam alongside as the steamer made its way, tasting their native waters in this foreign land. But eventually the river narrowed and deepened again, and soon ahead of them began to rise the mountains of the great Central Asian Plateau. Will saw a rim of white on the horizon one day, and watched as it grew and grew, separating itself into different peaks and ridges and passes between them, and so high that it seemed that they must be close at hand, only a few miles. But they were far off still. It was just that the mountains were immense, and with every hour that they came closer, they seemed yet more inconceivably high. Most of the bears had never seen mountains, apart from the cliffs on their own island of Svalbard, and fell silent as they looked up at the giant ramparts, still so far off.
"What will we hunt there, Yorick Bernison?"
said one.
"Are there seals in the mountains? How shall we live?" "There is snow and ice. We shall be comfortable. And there are wild creatures there in plenty. Our lives will be different for a while. But we shall survive, and when things return to what they should be, and the Arctic freezes once more, we shall still be alive to go back and claim it. If we had stayed there, we would have starved. Be prepared for strangeness and for new ways, my bears."
Eventually the steamer could sail no further, because at this point the riverbed had narrowed and become shallow. The skipper brought the vessel to a halt in a valley bottom that normally would have been carpeted with grass and mountain flowers, where the river would have meandered over gravel beds. But the valley was now a lake, and the captain insisted that he dared not go past it. Beyond this point, he explained, there would not be enough depth below the keel, even with the massive flood from the north. So they drew up to the edge of the valley, where an outcrop of rock formed a sort of jetty, and disembarked.
"Where are we now?"
said Will to the captain, whose English was limited. The captain found a tattered old map and jabbed at it with his pipe, saying,
"This valley here, we now. You take. Go on."
"Thank you, very much,"
Will said, and wondered if he ought to offer to pay. But the captain had turned away to supervise the unloading. Before long, all 30 or so bears and all their armour were on the narrow shore. The captain shouted an order, and the vessel began to turn ponderously against the current, manoeuvring out into midstream and giving a blast on the whistle that echoed for a long time around the valley. Will sat on a rock, reading the map. If he was right, the valley where Lyra was captive, according to the angel, lay some way to the east and the south, and the best way there led through a pass called Sung Chen.
"Bears, mark this place,"
said Yorick Birnison to his subjects.
"When the time comes for us to move back to the Arctic, we shall assemble here. Now go your ways, hunt, feed, and live. Do not make war. We are not here for war. If war threatens, I shall call for you."
The bears were solitary creatures for the most part, and they only came together in times of war or emergency. Now that they were at the edge of a land of snow, they were impatient to be off, each of them, exploring on their own.
"Come then, Will, and we shall find Lyra."
Will lifted his rucksack, and they set off. It was good walking for the first part of their journey. The sun was warm, but the pines and the rhododendrons kept the worst of the heat off their shoulders, and the air was fresh and clear. The ground was rocky, but the rocks were thick with moss and pine needles, and the slopes they climbed were not precipitous. Will found himself relishing the exercise. The days he had spent on the boat, the enforced rest, had built up his strength. When he had come across Yorick, he had been at the very last of it. He didn't know that, but the bear did. And as soon as they were alone, Will showed Yorick how the other edge of the knife worked. He opened a world where a tropical rainforest steamed and dripped, and where vapours laden with heavy scent drifted out into the thin mountain air. Yorick watched closely, and touched the edge of the window with his paw, and sniffed at it, and stepped through into the hot, moist air to look around in silence. The monkey shrieks and bird calls, the insect scrapings and frog croakings, and the incessant drip-drip of condensing moisture sounded very loud to Will, outside it. Then Yorick came back and watched Will close the window, and asked to see the knife again, peering so closely at the silver edge that Will thought he was in danger of cutting his eye. He examined it for a long time, and handed it back with hardly a word, only saying,
"I was right. I could not have fought this."
They moved on, speaking little, which suited them both. Yorick Birnison caught a gazelle and ate most of it, leaving the tender meat for Will to cook. And once they came to a village, and while Yorick waited in the forest, Will exchanged one of his gold coins for some flat, coarse bread and some dried fruit, and for boots of yak leather and a waistcoat of a kind of sheepskin, for it was becoming cold at night. He also managed to ask about the valley with the rainbows. Balthamos helped by assuming the form of a crow, like the demon of the man Will was speaking to. He made the passage of understanding easier between them, and Will got directions which were helpful and clear. It was another 3 days' walk. Well, they were getting there. And so were others. Lord Asriel's force, the squadron of gyropters and the Zeppelin fuel tanker, had reached the opening between the worlds, the breach in the sky above Svalbard. They had a very long way to go still, but they flew without pause except for essential maintenance. And the commander, the Afric King Ogunwe, kept in twice daily touch with the basalt fortress. He had a Galivespian lodestone operator aboard his gyropter, and through him he was able to learn as quickly as Lord Asriel himself about what was going on elsewhere. The news was disconcerting. A little spy, the Lady Salmakia, had watched from the shadows as the two powerful arms of the Church, the Consistorial Court of Discipline and the Society of the Work of the Holy Spirit, agreed to put their differences aside and pool their knowledge. The Society had a swifter and more skillful alethiometrist than Fra Pavel, and thanks to him, the Consistorial Court now knew exactly where Lyra was, and more. They knew that Lord Asriel had sent a force to rescue her. Wasting no time, the court commandeered a flight of Zeppelins, and that same day a battalion of the Swiss Guard began to embark aboard the Zeppelins waiting in the still air beside the Lake of Geneva. So each side was aware that the other was also making its way towards the cave in the mountains, and they both knew that whoever got there first would have the advantage, but there wasn't much in it. Lord Asriel's gyropters were faster than the Zeppelins of the Consistorial Court, but they had further to fly, and they were limited by the speed of their own Zeppelin tanker. And there was another consideration. Whoever seized Lyra first would have to fight their way out against the other force. It would be easier for the Consistorial Court, because they didn't have to consider getting Lyra away safely. They were flying there to kill her. The Zeppelin carrying the president of the consistorial court was carrying other passengers as well, unknown to him. The Chevalier Tialis had received a message on his lodestone resonator, ordering him and the Lady Salmakia to smuggle themselves aboard. When the Zeppelins arrived at the valley, he and the lady were to go ahead and make their way independently to the cave where Lyra was held, and protect her as well as they could until King Ogunwe's force arrived to rescue her. Her safety was to come above every other consideration. Getting themselves aboard the Zeppelin was hazardous for the spies, not least because of the equipment they had to carry. Apart from the lodestone resonator, the most important items were a pair of insect larvae and their food. When the adult insects emerged, they would be more like dragonflies than anything else, but they were not like any kind of dragonfly that the humans of Will's world, or Lyra's, would have seen before. They were very much larger, for one thing. The Gallivespians bred these creatures carefully, and each clan's insects differed from the rest. The Chevalier Tialis's clan bred powerful red and yellow striped dragonflies with vigorous and brutal appetites, whereas the one the Lady Salmakia was nurturing would be a slender, fast-flying creature with an electric blue body and the power of glowing in the dark. Every spy was equipped with a number of these larvae, which, by feeding them carefully regulated amounts of oil and honey, they could either keep in suspended animation or bring rapidly to adulthood. Tialis and Salmakia had 36 hours, depending on the winds, to hatch these larvae now, because that was about the time the flight would take, and they needed the insects to emerge before the Zeppelins landed. The Chevalier and his colleague found an overlooked space behind a bulkhead and made themselves as safe as they could while the vessel was loaded and fueled. And then the engines began to roar, shaking the light structure from end to end as the ground crew cast off and the 8 Zeppelins rose into the night sky. Their kind would have regarded the comparison as a mortal insult, but they were able to conceal themselves at least as well as rats. From their hiding place, the Gallivespians could overhear a good deal, and they kept in hourly touch with Lord Roke, who was aboard King Ogunwe's gyropter. But there was one thing they couldn't learn any more about on the Zeppelin, because the President never spoke of it, and that was the matter of the assassin, Father Gomez, who had been absolved already of the sin he was going to commit if the consistorial court failed in their mission. Father Gomez was somewhere else, and no one was tracking him at all. Chapter 10 Wheels.
There ariseth a little cloud out of the sea, like a man's hand. The First Book of Kings.
Yeah,
said the red-haired girl in the garden of the deserted casino.
We seen her. Me and Paolo both seen her. She come through here days ago.
Father Gomez said,
And do you remember what she looked like?
She looked hot,
said the little boy.
Sweaty in the face, all right?
How old did she seem to be?
About, I suppose maybe 40 or 50. We didn't see her close. She could be 30 maybe, but she was hot, like Paolo said. And she was carrying a big rucksack, much bigger than yours, this big.
Paolo whispered something to her, screwing up his eyes to look at the priest as he did so. The sun was bright in his face.
Yeah,
said the girl.
I know. The specters,
she said to Father Gomez.
She wasn't afraid of the specters at all. She just walked through the city and never worried a bit. I ain't never seen a grown-up do that before, all right? She looked like she didn't know about them even. Same as you,
she added, looking at him with a challenge in her eyes.
There's a lot I don't know.
The little boy plucked at her sleeve and whispered again.
Paolo says,
she told the priest,
he thinks you're going to get the knife back.
Father Gomez felt his skin bristle. He remembered the testimony of Fra Pavel in the inquiry at the consistorial court. This must be the knife he meant.
If I can, I shall. The knife comes from here, does it?
From the Torre degli Angeli,
said the girl, pointing at the square stone tower over the red-brown rooftops. It shimmered in the midday glare.
And the boy who stole it, he kill our brother Tullio. Oh, the specters got him all right. You want to kill that boy, that's okay. And the girl, she was a liar. She was as bad as him.
There was a girl, too,
said the priest, trying not to seem too interested.
Lying filth. We nearly killed them both. But then there came some women, flying women.
Witches.
Witches, and we couldn't fight them. They took them away, the girl and boy. We don't know where they went. But the woman, she came later. We thought maybe she got some kind of knife to keep the specters away, all right? And maybe you have too,
she added, lifting her chin to stare at him boldly.
I have no knife, but I have a sacred task. Maybe that is protecting me against these specters.
Yeah, maybe. Anyway, you want her? She went south, towards the mountains. We don't know where, but you ask anyone. They know if she go past, because there ain't no one like her in Chigatse. Not before and not now. She'd be easy to find.
Thank you, Angelica. Bless you, my children.
He shouldered his pack, left the garden, and set off through the hot, silent streets, satisfied. After 3 days in the company of the wheeled creatures, Mary Malone knew rather more about them, and they knew a great deal about her. That first morning they carried her for an hour or so along the basalt highway to a settlement by a river, and the journey was uncomfortable. She had nothing to hold on to, and the creature's back was hard. They sped along at a pace that frightened her, but the thunder of their wheels on the hard road and the beat of their scudding feet made her exhilarated enough to ignore the discomfort. And in the course of the ride she became more aware of the creature's physiology. Like the grazers' skeletons, theirs had a diamond-shaped frame with a limb at each of the corners. Sometime in the distant past, a line of ancestral creatures must have developed this structure and found it worked, just as generations of long-ago crawling things in Mary's world had developed the central spine. The basalt highway led gradually downwards, and after a while the slope increased so the creatures could freewheel. They tucked their side legs up and steered by leaning to one side or the other, and hurtled along at a speed Mary found terrifying, though she had to admit that the creature she was riding never gave her the slightest feeling of danger. If only she'd had something to hold on to, she would have enjoyed it. At the foot of the mile-long slope there was a stand of the great trees, and nearby a river meandered on the level grassy ground. Some way off, Mary saw a gleam that looked like a wider expanse of water, but she didn't spend long looking at that because the creatures were making for a settlement on the riverbank, and she was burning with curiosity to see it. There were 20 or 30 huts, roughly grouped in a circle, made of, she had to shade her eyes against the sun to see, wooden beams covered with a kind of wattle and daub mixture on the walls and thatch on the roofs. Other wheeled creatures were working, some repairing a roof, others hauling a net out of the river, others bringing brushwood for a fire. So they had language, and they had fire, and they had society. And about then she found an adjustment being made in her mind, as the word creatures became the word people. These beings weren't human, but they were people, she told herself. It's not them, they're us. They were quite close now, and seeing what was coming, some of the villagers looked up and called to each other to look. The party from the road slowed to a halt, and Mary clambered stiffly down, knowing that she would ache later on.
Thank you,
she said to her. Her what? Her steed? Her cycle? Both ideas were absurdly wrong for the bright-eyed amiability that stood beside her. She settled for friend. He raised his trunk and imitated her words.
Anku,
he said, and again they laughed in high spirits. She took her rucksack from the other creature.
Anku, Anku,
and walked with them off the basalt and onto the hard-packed earth of the village. And then her absorption truly began. In the next few days she learned so much that she felt like a child again, bewildered by school. What was more, the wheeled people seemed to be just as wonderstruck by her. Her hands, to begin with. They couldn't get enough of them. Their delicate trunks felt over every joint, searching out thumbs, knuckles and fingernails, flexing them gently, and they watched with amazement as she picked up her rucksack, conveyed food to her mouth, scratched, combed her hair, washed. In return, they let her feel their trunks. They were infinitely flexible, and about as long as her arm, thicker where they joined the head, and quite powerful enough to crush her skull, she guessed. The two finger-like projections at the tip were capable of enormous force and great gentleness. The creatures seemed to be able to vary the tone of their skin on the underside, on their equivalent of fingertips, from a soft velvet to a solidity like wood. As a result, they could use them for both a delicate task, like milking a grazer, and the rough business of tearing and shaping branches. Little by little, Mary realized that their trunks were playing a part in communication, too. A movement of the trunk would modify the meaning of a sound, so the word that sounded like ch meant water when it was accompanied by a sweep of the trunk from left to right, rain when the trunk curled up at the tip, sadness when it curled under, and young shoots of grass when it made a quick flick to the left. As soon as she saw this, Mary imitated it, moving her arm as best she could in the same way, and when the creatures realized that she was beginning to talk to them, their delight was radiant. Once they had begun to talk, mostly in the Weald people's language, although she managed to teach them a few words of English, they could say Anku and grass and tree and sky and river, and pronounce her name with a little difficulty, they progressed much more quickly. Their word for themselves as a people was Mulefa, but an individual was a Zalif. Mary thought there was a difference between the sounds for he Zalif and she Zalif, but it was too subtle for her to imitate easily. She began to write it all down and compile a dictionary. But before she let herself become truly absorbed, she took out her battered paperback and the yarrow stalks and asked the I Ching, "Should I be here doing this, or should I go on somewhere else and keep searching?" The reply came, "Keeping still so that restlessness dissolves. Then, beyond the tumult, one can perceive the great laws." It went on, "As a mountain keeps still within itself, thus a wise man does not permit his will to stray beyond his situation." That could hardly be clearer. She folded the stalks away and closed the book, and then realized that she'd drawn a circle of watching creatures around her. One said,
"Question, permission, curious."
She said,
"Please, look."
Very delicately their trunks moved, sorting through the stalks in the same counting movement she'd been making, or turning the pages of the book. One thing they were astonished by was the doubleness of her hands, by the fact that she could both hold the book and turn the pages at the same time. They loved to watch her lace her fingers together, or play the childhood game of this is the church and this is the steeple, or make that over and over thumb to opposite forefinger movement that was what Amma was using at exactly the same moment in Lyra's world, as a charm to keep evil spirits away. Once they had examined the yarrow stalks and the book, they folded the cloth over them carefully and put them with the book into her rucksack. She was happy and reassured by the message from ancient China, because it meant that what she wanted most to do was exactly, at that moment, what she should do. So she set herself to learning more about the Mulefa, with a cheerful heart. She learned that there were two sexes, and that they lived monogamously in couples. Their offspring had long childhoods, 10 years at least, growing very slowly, as far as she could interpret their explanation. There were 5 young ones in this settlement, one almost grown and the others somewhere in between, and being smaller than the adults, they could not manage the seed pod wheels. The children had to move as the grazers did, with all 4 feet on the ground, but for all their energy and adventurousness, skipping up to Mary and shying away, trying to clamber up tree trunks, floundering in the shallow water and so on, they seemed clumsy, as if they were in the wrong element. The speed and power and grace of the adults was startling by contrast, and Mary saw how much a growing youngster must long for the day when the wheels would fit. She watched the oldest child, one day, go quietly to the storehouse where a number of seed pods were kept, and try to fit his foreclaw into the central hole. But when he tried to stand up, he fell over at once, trapping himself, and the sound attracted an adult. The child struggled to get free, squeaking with anxiety, and Mary couldn't help laughing at the sight, at the indignant parent and the guilty child, who pulled himself out at the last minute and scampered away. The seed pod wheels were clearly of the utmost importance, and soon Mary began to see just how valuable they were. The Mulefa spent much of their time, to begin with, in maintaining their wheels. By deftly lifting and twisting the claw, they could slip it out of the hole, and then they used their trunks to examine the wheel all over, cleaning the rim, checking for cracks. The claw was formidably strong, a spur of horn or bone at right angles to the leg, and slightly curved so that the highest part in the middle bore the weight as it rested on the inside of the hole. Mary watched one day as a Zalif examined the hole in her front wheel, touching here and there, lifting her trunk up in the air and back again, as if sampling the scent. Mary remembered the oil she'd found on her fingers when she'd examined the first seed pod. With the Zalif's permission, she looked at her claw, and found the surface more smooth and slick than anything she'd felt on her world. Her fingers simply would not stay on the surface. The whole of the claw seemed impregnated with the faintly fragrant oil, and after she had seen a number of the villagers sampling, testing, checking the state of their wheels and their claws, she began to wonder which had come first, wheel or claw, rider or tree. Although, of course, there was a third element as well, and that was geology. Creatures could only use wheels on a world that provided them with natural highways. There must be some feature of the mineral content of these stone roads that made them run in ribbon-like lines over the vast savanna and be so resistant to weathering or cracking. Little by little, Mary came to see the way everything was linked together, and all of it, seemingly, managed by the Mulefa. They knew the location of every herd of grazers, every stand of wheel trees, every clump of sweet grass, and they knew every individual within the herds and every separate tree, and they discussed their well-being and their fate. On one occasion she saw the Mulefa cull a herd of grazers, selecting some individuals and herding them away from the rest, to dispatch them by breaking their necks with a wrench of a powerful trunk. Nothing was wasted. Holding flakes of razor-sharp stone in their trunks, the Mulefa skinned and gutted the animals within minutes, and then began a skillful butchery, separating out the offal and the tender meat and the tougher joints, trimming the fat, removing the horns and the hooves, and working so efficiently that Mary watched with the pleasure she felt at seeing anything done well. Soon strips of meat were hanging to dry in the sun, and others were packed in salt and wrapped in leaves. The skins were scraped clear of fat, which was set by for later use, and then laid to soak in pits of water filled with oak bark to tan. And the oldest child was playing with a set of horns, pretending to be a grazer, making the other children laugh. That evening there was fresh meat to eat, and Mary feasted well. In a similar way, the Mulefa knew where the best fish were to be had, and exactly when and where to lay their nets. Looking for something she could do, Mary went to the net makers and offered to help. When she saw how they worked, not on their own, but two by two, working their trunks together to tie a knot, she realized why they'd been so astonished by her hands, because, of course, she could tie knots on her own. At first she felt that this gave her an advantage. She needed no one else. And then she realized how it cut her off from others. Perhaps all human beings were like that. And from that time on, she used one hand to knot the fibers, sharing the task with a female Zalif who had become her particular friend, fingers and trunk moving in and out together. But of all the living things the Wheeled people managed, it was the seed pod trees that they took most care with. There were half a dozen groves within the area looked after by this group. There were others further away, but they were the responsibility of other groups. Each day a party went out to check on the well-being of the mighty trees and to harvest any fallen seed pods. It was clear what the Mulefa gained, but how did the trees benefit from this interchange? One day she saw. As she was riding along with the group, suddenly there was a loud crack, and everyone came to a halt, surrounding one individual whose wheel had split. Every group carried a spare or two with it, so the Zalif with the broken wheel was soon remounted, but the broken wheel itself was carefully wrapped in a cloth and taken back to the settlement. There they prized it open and took out all the seeds, flat pale ovals as big as Mary's little fingernail, and examined each one carefully. They explained that the seed pods needed the constant pounding they got on the hard roads if they were to crack at all, and also that the seeds were difficult to germinate. Without the Mulefa's attention, the trees would all die. Each species depended on the other, and furthermore, it was the oil that made it possible. It was hard to understand, but they seemed to be saying that the oil was the center of their thinking and feeling, that young ones didn't have the wisdom of their elders because they couldn't use the wheels, and thus could absorb no oil through their claws. And that was when Mary began to see the connection between the Mulefa and the question that had occupied the past few years of her life. But before she could examine it any further, and conversations with the Mulefa were long and complex because they loved qualifying and explaining and illustrating their arguments with dozens of examples, as if they'd forgotten nothing and everything they had ever known was available immediately for reference, the settlement was attacked. Mary was the first to see the attackers coming, though she didn't know what they were. It happened in mid-afternoon when she was helping repair the roof of a hut. The Mulefa only built one story high because they were not climbers, but Mary was happy to clamber above the ground, and she could lay thatch and knot it in place with her two hands once they had shown her the technique, much more quickly than they could. So she was braced against the rafters of her house, catching the bundles of reeds thrown up to her, and enjoying the cool breeze from the water that was tempering the heat of the sun, when her eye was caught by a flash of white. It came from that distant glitter she thought was the sea. She shaded her eyes and saw one, two, more, a fleet of tall white sails emerging out of the heat haze, some way off but making with a silent grace for the river mouth.
"Mary!"
called the Zalif from below.
"What are you seeing?"
She didn't know the word for sail or boat, so she said,
"Tall, white, many."
At once the Zalif gave a call of alarm, and everyone in earshot stopped work and sped to the centre of the settlement, calling the young ones. Within a minute, all the Mulefa were ready to flee. Atal, her friend, called,
"Mary, Mary, come, Twalapi, Twalapi."
It had all happened so quickly that Mary had hardly moved. The white sails by this time had already entered the river, easily making headway against the current. Mary was impressed by the discipline of the sailors. They tacked so swiftly, the sails moving together like a flock of starlings, all changing direction simultaneously. And they were so beautiful, those snow-white slender sails, bending and dipping and filling. There were 40 of them at least, and they were coming upriver much more swiftly than she'd thought. But she saw no crew on board, and then she realized that they weren't boats at all. They were gigantic birds, and the sails were their wings, one fore and one aft, held upright and flexed and trimmed by the power of their own muscles. There was no time to stop and study them, because they had already reached the bank and were climbing out. They had necks like swans and beaks as long as her forearm. Their wings were twice as tall as she was, and she glanced back, frightened now, over her shoulder as she fled. They had powerful legs. No wonder they had moved so fast on the water. She ran hard after the Mulefa, who were calling her name as they streamed out of the settlement and onto the highway. She reached them just in time. Her friend Atal was waiting, and as Mary scrambled on her back, Atal beat the road with her feet, speeding away up the slope after her companions. The birds, who couldn't move as fast on land, soon gave up the chase and turned back to the settlement. They tore open the food stores, snarling and growling and tossing their great cruel beaks high as they swallowed the dried meat and all the preserved fruit and grain. Everything edible was gone in under a minute. And then the Twalapi found the wheel store and tried to smash open the great seed pods, but that was beyond them. Mary felt her friends tense with alarm all around her as they watched from the crest of the low hill and saw pod after pod hurled to the ground, kicked, rasped by the claws on the mighty legs, but of course no harm came to them from that. What worried the Mulefa was that several of them were pushed and shoved and nudged towards the water, where they floated heavily downstream towards the sea. Then the great snow-white birds set about demolishing everything they could see with brutal, raking blows of their feet and stabbing, smashing, shaking, tearing movements of their beaks. The Mulefa around her were murmuring, almost crooning with sorrow.
"I help,"
Mary said.
"We make again."
But the foul creatures hadn't finished yet. Holding their beautiful wings high, they squatted among the devastation and voided their bowels. The smell drifted up the slope with the breeze. Heaps and pools of green, black, brown, white dung lay among the broken beams, the scattered thatch. Then their clumsy movement on land giving them a swaggering strut, the birds went back to the water and sailed away downstream towards the sea. Only when the last white wing had vanished in the afternoon haze did the Mulefa ride down the highway again. They were full of sorrow and anger, but mainly they were powerfully anxious about the seed pod store. Out of the 15 pods that had been there, only 2 were left. The rest had been pushed into the water and lost. But there was a sandbank in the next bend of the river, and Mary thought she could spot a wheel that was caught there. So to the Mulefa's surprise and alarm, she took off her clothes, wound a length of cord around her waist, and swam across to it. On the sandbank she found not one but 5 of the precious wheels, and passing the cord through their softening centres, she swam heavily back, pulling them behind her. The Mulefa were full of gratitude. They never entered the water themselves, and only fished from the bank, taking care to keep their feet and wheels dry. Mary felt she had done something useful for them at last. Later that night, after a scanty meal of sweet roots, they told her why they had been so anxious about the wheels. There had once been a time when the seed pods were plentiful, and when the world was rich and full of life, and the Mulefa lived with their trees in perpetual joy. But something bad had happened many years ago. Some virtue had gone out of the world, because despite every effort and all the love and attention the Mulefa could give them, the wheelpod trees were dying. Chapter 11. The Dragonflies.
A truth that's told with bad intent beats all the lies you can invent. William Blake.
Amma climbed the path to the cave, bread and milk in the bag on her back, a heavy puzzlement in her heart. How in the world could she ever manage to reach the sleeping girl? She came to the rock where the woman had told her to leave the food. She put it down, but she didn't go straight home. She climbed a little further, up past the cave and through the thick rhododendrons, and further up still to where the trees thinned out and the rainbows began. There she and her demon played a game. They climbed up over the rock shelves and around the little green-white cataracts, past the whirlpools and through the spectrum-tinted spray, until her hair and her eyelids and his squirrel fur were beaded all over with a million tiny pearls of moisture. The game was to get to the top without wiping your eyes, despite the temptation, and soon the sunlight sparkled and fractured into red, yellow, green, blue, and all the colours in between. But she mustn't brush her hand across to see better until she got right to the top, or the game would be lost. Kulang, her demon, sprang to a rock near the top of the little waterfall, and she knew he'd turn at once to make sure she didn't brush the moisture off her eyelashes. Except that he didn't. Instead, he clung there, gazing forward. Amma wiped her eyes because the game was cancelled by the surprise her demon was feeling. As she pulled herself up to look over the edge, she gasped and fell still, because looking down at her was the face of a creature she had never seen before. A bear, but immense, terrifying, 4 times the size of the brown bears in the forest, and ivory white, with a black nose and black eyes and claws the length of daggers. He was only an arm's length away. She could see every separate hair on his head.
"Who's that?"
said the voice of a boy, and while Amma couldn't understand the words, she caught the sense easily enough. After a moment, the boy appeared next to the bear, fierce-looking, with frowning eyes and a jutting jaw. And was that a demon beside him, bird-shaped? But such a strange bird, unlike any she'd seen before. It flew to Kulang and spoke briefly.
"Friends, we shan't hurt you."
The great white bear hadn't moved at all.
"Come up,"
said the boy, and again her demon made sense of it for her. Watching the bear with superstitious awe, Amma scrambled up beside the little waterfall and stood shyly on the rocks. Kulang became a butterfly and settled for a moment on her cheek, but left it to flutter around the other demon, who sat still on the boy's hand.
"Will,"
said the boy, pointing to himself. She responded,
"Amma."
Now that she could see him properly, she was frightened of the boy almost more than the bear. He had a horrible wound. 2 of his fingers were missing. She felt dizzy when she saw it. The bear turned away along the milky stream and lay down in the water as if to cool himself. The boy's demon took to the air and fluttered with Kulang among the rainbows, and slowly they began to understand each other. And what should they turn out to be looking for but a cave, with a girl asleep? The words tumbled out of her in response.
"I know where it is, and she's being kept asleep by a woman who says she is her mother. But no mother would be so cruel, would she? She makes her drink something to keep her asleep. But I have some herbs to make her wake up, if only I could get to her."
Will could only shake his head and wait for Balthamos to translate. It took more than a minute.
"Yorick,"
he called, and the bear lumbered along the bed of the stream, licking his chops, for he had just swallowed a fish.
"Yorick,"
Will said,
"this girl is saying she knows where Lyra is. I'll go with her to look while you stay here and watch."
Yorick Birnison, 4 square in the stream, nodded silently. Will hid his rucksack and buckled on the knife before clambering down through the rainbows with Amma. The mist that filled the air was icy. He had to brush his eyes and peer through the dazzle to see where it was safe to put his feet. When they reached the foot of the falls, Amma indicated that they should go carefully and make no noise, and Will walked behind her down the slope, between mossy rocks and great gnarled pine trunks, where the dappled light danced intensely green and a billion tiny insects scraped and sang. Down they went, and further down, and still the sunlight followed them deep into the valley, while overhead the branches tossed unceasingly in the bright sky. Then Amma halted. Will drew himself behind the massive bole of a cedar and looked where she was pointing. Through a tangle of leaves and branches, he saw the side of a cliff rising up to the right, and partway up...
"Mrs. Coulter,"
he whispered, and his heart was beating fast. The woman appeared from behind the rock and shook out a thick-leaved branch before dropping it and brushing her hands together. Had she been sweeping the floor? Her sleeves were rolled and her hair was bound up with a scarf. Will could never have imagined her looking so domestic. But then there was a flash of gold, and that vicious monkey appeared, leaping up to her shoulder. As if they suspected something, they looked all around, and suddenly Mrs. Coulter didn't look domestic at all. Amma was whispering urgently. She was afraid of the golden monkey demon. He liked to tear the wings off bats while they were still alive.
"Is there anyone else with her? No soldiers or anyone like that?"
Amma didn't know. She had never seen soldiers, but people did talk about strange and frightening men. Or they might be ghosts, seen on the mountainsides at night. But there had always been ghosts in the mountains, everyone knew that. So they might not have anything to do with the woman. "Well," thought Will, "if Lyra's in the cave and Mrs. Coulter doesn't leave it, I'll have to go and pay a call."
"What is this drug you have? What do you have to do with it to wake her up?"
Amma explained.
"And where is it now?"
"In her home," she said, "hidden away."
"All right. Wait here and don't come near. When you see her, you mustn't say that you know me. You've never seen me or the bear. When do you next bring her food?"
"Half an hour before sunset," Amma's demon said.
"Bring the medicine with you then,"
said Will.
"I'll meet you here."
She watched with great unease as he set off along the path. Surely he didn't believe what she had just told him about the monkey demon, or he wouldn't walk so recklessly up to the cave. Actually, Will felt very nervous. All his senses seemed to be clarified, so that he was aware of the tiniest insects drifting in the sun shafts and the rustle of every leaf and the movement of the clouds above, even though his eyes never left the cave mouth.
"Balthamus,"
he whispered, and the angel demon flew to his shoulder as a bright-eyed small bird with red wings.
"Keep close to me and watch that monkey.
Then look to your right."
And Will saw a patch of golden light at the cave mouth that had a face and eyes and was watching them. They were no more than 20 paces away. He stood still and the golden monkey turned his head to look in the cave, said something, and turned back. Will felt for the knife handle and walked on. When he reached the cave, the woman was waiting for him. She was sitting at her ease in the little canvas chair, with a book on her lap, watching him calmly. She was wearing traveller's clothes of khaki, but so well were they cut and so graceful was her figure that they looked like the highest of high fashion, and the little spray of red blossom she'd pinned to her shirt front looked like the most elegant of jewels. Her hair shone and her dark eyes glittered, and her bare legs gleamed golden in the sunlight. She smiled. Will very nearly smiled in response, because he was so unused to the sweetness and gentleness a woman could put into a smile, and it unsettled him.
"You're Will."
"How do you know my name?"
"Lyra says it in her sleep."
"Where is she?"
"Safe."
"I want to see her."
"Come on then,"
she said, and got to her feet, dropping the book on the chair. For the first time since coming into her presence, Will looked at the monkey demon. His fur was long and lustrous, each hair seeming to be made of pure gold, much finer than a human's, and his little face and hands were black. Will had last seen that face, contorted with hate, on the evening when he and Lyra stole the alethiometer back from Sir Charles Latram in the house in Oxford. The monkey had tried to tear at him with his teeth until Will had slashed left-right with the knife, forcing the demon backwards, so he could close the window and shut them away in a different world. Will thought that nothing on earth would make him turn his back on that monkey now. But the bird-shaped Balthamos was watching closely, and Will stepped carefully over the floor of the cave and followed Mrs. Coulter to the little figure lying still in the shadows. And there she was, his dearest friend, asleep. So small she looked. He was amazed at how all the force and fire that was Lyra awake could look so gentle and mild when she was sleeping. At her neck Pantalaimon lay in his polecat shape, his fur glistening, and Lyra's hair lay damp across her forehead. He knelt down beside her and lifted the hair away. Her face was hot. Out of the corner of his eye, Will saw the golden monkey crouching to spring and set his hand on the knife. But Mrs. Coulter shook her head very slightly, and the monkey relaxed. Without seeming to, Will was memorizing the exact layout of the cave, the shape and size of every rock, the slope of the floor, the exact height of the ceiling above the sleeping girl. He would need to find his way through it in the dark, and this was the only chance he'd have to see it first.
So you see she's quite safe,
said Mrs. Coulter.
Why are you keeping her here? And why don't you let her wake up?
Let's sit down.
She didn't take the chair, but sat with him on the moss-covered rocks at the entrance to the cave. She sounded so kindly, and there was such sad wisdom in her eyes, that Will's mistrust deepened. He felt that every word she said was a lie, every action concealed a threat, and every smile was a mask of deceit. Well, he would have to deceive her in turn. He'd have to make her think he was harmless. He had successfully deceived every teacher and every police officer and every social worker and every neighbor who had ever taken an interest in him and his home. He'd been preparing for this all his life. Right, he thought. I can deal with you.
Would you like something to drink?
Said Mrs. Coulter.
I'll have some too. It's quite safe. Look.
She cut open some wrinkled brownish fruit and pressed the cloudy juice into two small beakers. She sipped one and offered the other to Will, who sipped too and found it fresh and sweet.
How did you find your way here?
It wasn't hard to follow you.
Evidently. Have you got Lyra's alethiometer?
Yes,
he said, and let her work out for herself whether or not he could read it.
And you've got a knife, I understand.
Sir Charles told you that, did he?
Sir Charles? Oh, Carlo, of course. Yes, he did. It sounds fascinating. May I see it?
No, of course not. Why are you keeping Lyra here?
Because I love her. I'm her mother. She's in appalling danger, and I won't let anything happen to her.
Danger? From what?
Well,
she said, and set her beaker down on the ground, leaning forward so that her hair swung down on either side of her face. When she sat up again, she tucked it back behind her ears with both hands, and Will smelled the fragrance of some scent she was wearing, combined with the fresh smell of her body, and he felt disturbed. If Mrs. Coulter saw his reaction, she didn't show it.
Look, Will, I don't know how you came to meet my daughter, and I don't know what you know already, and I certainly don't know if I can trust you. But equally, I'm tired of having to lie. So here it is. The truth. I found out that my daughter is in danger from the very people I used to belong to. From the church. Frankly, I think they want to kill her. So I found myself in a dilemma, you see. Obey the church, or save my daughter. And I was a faithful servant of the church, too. There was no one more zealous. I gave my life to it. I served it with a passion. But I had this daughter. I know I didn't look after her well when she was young. She was taken away from me and brought up by strangers. Perhaps that made it hard for her to trust me. But when she was growing up, I saw the danger that she was in, and three times now I've tried to save her from it. I've had to become a renegade and hide in this remote place, and I thought we were safe. But now to learn that you found us so easily, well, you can understand that worries me. The church won't be far behind, and they want to kill her, Will. They will not let her live.
Why? Why do they hate her so much?
Because of what they think she's going to do. I don't know what that is. I wish I did, because then I could keep her even more safe. But all I know is that they hate her. And they have no mercy. None.
She leaned forward, talking urgently and quietly and closely.
Why am I telling you this? Can I trust you? I think I have to. I can't escape any more. There's nowhere else to go. And if you're a friend of Lyra's, you might be my friend too. And I do need friends. I do need help. Everything's against me now. The church will destroy me too, as well as Lyra, if they find us. I'm alone, Will. Just me in a cave with my daughter, and all the forces of all the worlds are trying to track us down. And here you are to show how easy it is to find us, apparently. What are you going to do, Will? What do you want?
Why are you keeping her asleep?
He said, stubbornly avoiding her questions.
Because what would happen if I let her wake? She'd run away at once, and she wouldn't last 5 days.
But why don't you explain it to her and give her the choice?
Do you think she'd listen? Do you think even if she listened, she'd believe me? She doesn't trust me. She hates me, Will, you must know that. She despises me. I don't know how to say it. I love her so much, I've given up everything I had. A great career, great happiness, position and wealth, everything. To come to this cave in the mountains and live on dry bread and sour fruit just so I can keep my daughter alive. And if to do that I have to keep her asleep, then so be it. But I must keep her alive. Wouldn't your mother do as much for you?
Will felt a jolt of shock and rage that Mrs. Coulter had dared to bring his own mother in to support her argument. Then the first shock was complicated by the thought that his mother, after all, had not protected him. He had had to protect her. Did Mrs. Coulter love Lyra more than Elaine Parry loved him? But that was unfair. His mother wasn't well. Either Mrs. Coulter did not know the boil of feelings that her simple words had lanced, or she was monstrously clever. Her beautiful eyes watched mildly as Will reddened and shifted uncomfortably. And for a moment Mrs. Coulter looked uncannily like her daughter.
But what are you going to do?
Well, I've seen Lyra now and she's alive. That's clear. And she's safe, I suppose. That's all I was going to do. So now I've done it, I can go and help Lord Asriel like I was supposed to.
That did surprise her a little, but she mastered it.
You don't mean... I thought you might help us. With the knife. I saw what you did at Sir Charles's house. You could make it safe for us, couldn't you? You could help us get away.
I'm going to go now,
Will said, standing up. She held out her hand. A rueful smile, a shrug, and a nod as if to a skillful opponent who'd made a good move at the chessboard. That was what her body said. He found himself liking her because she was brave, and because she seemed like a more complicated and richer and deeper Lyra. He couldn't help but like her. So he shook her hand, finding it firm and cool and soft. She turned to the golden monkey, who had been sitting behind her all the time, and a look passed between them that Will couldn't interpret. Then she turned back with a smile.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, Will.
He left the cave, knowing her eyes were following, and he didn't look back once. Amma was nowhere in sight. He walked back the way he'd come, keeping to the path until he heard the sound of the waterfall ahead.
She's lying,
Will said to Yorick Birnison 30 minutes later.
Of course she's lying. She'd lie even if it made things worse for herself, because she just loves lying too much to stop.
What is your plan, then?
Said the bear, who was basking in the sunlight, his belly flat down in a patch of snow among the rocks. Will walked up and down, wondering whether he could use the trick that had worked in Oxford. Use the knife to move into another world and then go to a spot right next to where Lyra lay, cut back through into this world, pull her through into safety, and then close up again. That was the obvious thing to do. Why did he hesitate? Balthamos knew. In his own angel shape, shimmering like a heat haze in the sunlight, he said,
You were foolish to go to her. All you want to do now is see the woman again.
Yorick uttered a deep, quiet growl. At first Will thought he was warning Balthamos, but then with a little shock of embarrassment he realized that the bear was agreeing with the angel. The two of them had taken little notice of each other until now. Their modes of being were so different. But they were of one mind about this, clearly. And Will scowled. But it was true. He had been captivated by Mrs. Coulter. All his thoughts referred to her. When he thought of Lyra, it was to wonder how like her mother she'd be when she grew up. If he thought of the church, it was to wonder how many of the priests and cardinals were under her spell. If he thought of his own dead father, it was to wonder whether he would have detested her or admired her. And if he thought of his own mother, he felt his heart grimace. He walked away from the bear and stood on a rock from which he could see across the whole valley. In the clear, cold air, he could hear the distant tock, tock, of someone chopping wood. He could hear a dull iron bell around the neck of a sheep. He could hear the rustling of the treetops far below. The tiniest crevices in the mountains at the horizon were clear and sharp to his eyes, as were the vultures wheeling over some near-dead creature many miles away. There was no doubt about it. Balthamos was right. The woman had cast a spell on him. It was pleasant and tempting to think about those beautiful eyes and the sweetness of that voice, and to recall the way her arms rose to push back that shining hair. With an effort he came back to his senses and heard another sound altogether, a far distant drone. He turned this way and that to locate it, and found it in the north, the very direction he and Yorick had come from.
"Zeppelins,"
said the bear's voice, startling Will, for he hadn't heard the great creature come near. Yorick stood beside him, looking in the same direction, and then reared up high, fully twice the height of Will, his gaze intent.
"How many?"
8 of them,"
said Yorick after a minute, and then Will saw them too, little specks in a line.
"Can you tell how long it will take them to get here?"
"They will be here not long after nightfall."
"So we won't have very much darkness. That's a pity."
"What is your plan?"
"To make an opening and take Lyra through into another world, and close it again before her mother follows. The girl has a drug to wake Lyra up, but she couldn't explain very clearly how to use it, so she'll have to come into the cave as well. I don't want to put her in danger, though. Maybe you could distract Mrs. Coulter while we do that."
The bear grunted and closed his eyes. Will looked around for the angel and saw his shape outlined in droplets of mist in the late afternoon light.
"Balthamus, I'm going back into the forest now to find a safe place to make the first opening. I need you to keep watch for me and tell me the moment she comes near. Her, or that demon of hers."
Balthamus nodded and raised his wings to shake off the moisture. Then he soared up into the cold air and glided out over the valley, as Will began to search for a world where Lyra would be safe. In the creaking, thrumming, double bulkhead of the leading zeppelin, the dragonflies were hatching. The Lady Salmakia bent over the splitting cocoon of the electric blue one, easing the damp, filmy wings clear, taking care to let her face be the first thing that imprinted itself on the many faceted eyes, soothing the fine-stretched nerves, whispering its name to the brilliant creature, teaching it who it was. In a few minutes, the Chevalier Tialis would do the same to his. But for now, he was sending a message on the lodestone resonator, and his attention was fully occupied with the movement of the bow and his fingers. He transmitted,
"To Lord Roke, we are 3 hours from the estimated time of arrival at the valley. The Consistorial Court of Discipline intends to send a squad to the cave as soon as they land. It will divide into 2 units. The first unit will fight its way into the cave and kill the child, removing her head so as to prove her death. If possible, they will also capture the woman, though if that is impossible, they are to kill her. The second unit is to capture the boy alive. The remainder of the force will engage the gyropters of King Ogunwe. They estimate that the gyropters will arrive shortly after the zeppelins. In accordance with your orders, the Lady Salmakia and I will shortly leave the zeppelin and fly directly to the cave, where we shall try to defend the girl against the first unit, and hold them at bay until reinforcements arrive. We await your response."
The answer came almost immediately.
"To the Chevalier Tialis, in the light of your report, here is a change of plan. In order to prevent the enemy from killing the child, which would be the worst possible outcome, you and the Lady Salmakia are to cooperate with the boy. While he has the knife, he has the initiative. So if he opens another world and takes the girl into it, let him do so and follow them through. Stay by their side at all times."
The Chevalier Tialis replied,
"To Lord Roke, your message is heard and understood. The lady and I shall leave at once."
The little spy closed the resonator and gathered his equipment together.
"Tialis,"
came a whisper from the dark.
"It's hatching. You should come now."
He leapt up to the strut where his dragonfly had been struggling into the world and eased it gently free of the broken cocoon. Stroking its great fierce head, he lifted the heavy antennae, still moist and curled, and let the creature taste the flavour of his skin until it was entirely under his command. Salmakia was fitting her dragonfly with the harness she carried everywhere. Spider silk reins, stirrups of titanium, a saddle of hummingbird skin. It was almost weightless. Tialis did the same with his, easing the straps around the insect's body, tightening, adjusting. It would wear the harness till it died. Then he quickly slung the pack over his shoulder and sliced through the oiled fabric of the zeppelin's skin. Beside him, the lady had mounted her dragonfly, and now she urged it through the narrow gap into the hammering gusts. The long, frail wings trembled as she squeezed through, and then the joy of flight took over the creature, and it plunged into the wind. A few seconds later, Tialis joined her in the wild air, his mount eager to fight the swift-gathering dusk itself. The two of them whirled upwards in the icy currents, took a few moments to get their bearings, and set their course for the valley. Chapter 12. The Break.
Still as he fled, his eye was backward cast, as if his fear still followed him behind. Edmund Spencer.
As darkness fell, this was how things stood. In his adamant tower, Lord Asriel paced up and down. His attention was fixed on the little figure beside the lodestone resonator, and every other report had been diverted, every part of his mind was directed to the news that came to the small square block of stone under the lamplight. King Ogunwe sat in the cabin of his gyropter, swiftly working out a plan to counter the intentions of the consistorial court, which he just learned about from the Gallivespian in his own aircraft. The navigator was scribbling some figures on a scrap of paper, which he handed to the pilot. The essential thing was speed. Getting their troops on the ground first would make all the difference. The gyropters were faster than Zeppelins, but they were still some way behind. In the Zeppelins of the consistorial court, the Swiss guard were attending to their kit. Their crossbows were deadly over 500 yards, and an archer could load and fire 15 bolts a minute. The spiral fins made of horn gave the bolt a spin and made the weapon as accurate as a rifle. It was also, of course, silent, which might be a great advantage. Mrs. Coulter lay awake in the entrance to the cave. The golden monkey was restless and frustrated. The bats had left the cave with the coming of darkness, and there was nothing to torment. He prowled about by Mrs. Coulter's sleeping bag, scratching with a little horny finger at the occasional glowflies that settled in the cave, and smearing their luminescence over the rock. Lyra lay hot and almost as restless, but deep, deep asleep, locked into oblivion by the draught her mother had forced down her only an hour before. There was a dream that had occupied her for a long time, and now it had returned, and little whimpers of pity and rage and lyratic resolution shook her breast and her throat, making Pantalaimon grind his polecat teeth in sympathy. Not far away, under the wind-tossed pines on the forest path, Will and Amma were making their way towards the cave. Will had tried to explain to Amma what he was going to do, but her demon could make no sense of it, and when he cut a window and showed her, she was so terrified that she nearly fainted. He had to move calmly and speak quietly in order to keep her nearby, because she refused to let him take the powder from her, or even to tell him how it was to be used. In the end, he had to say simply,
"Keep very quiet and follow me,"
and hope that she would. Yorick, in his armor, was somewhere close by, waiting to hold off the soldiers from the Zeppelin so as to give Will enough time to work. What neither of them knew was that Lord Asriel's force was also closing in. The wind from time to time brought a far distant clatter to Yorick's ears, but whereas he knew what Zeppelin engines sounded like, he had never heard a gyropter, and he could make nothing of it. Balthamos might have been able to tell them, but Will was troubled about him. Now that they'd found Lyra, the angel had begun to withdraw back into his grief. He was silent, distracted, and sullen, and that in turn made it harder to talk to Amma. As they paused on the path, Will said to the air,
"Balthamos, are you there?"
"Yes."
"Balthamos, please stay with me. Stay close and warn me of any danger. I need you."
"I haven't abandoned you yet."
That was the best Will could get out of him. Far above, in the buffeting midair, Tialis and Salmakia soared over the valley, trying to see down to the cave. The dragonflies would do exactly as they were told, but their bodies couldn't easily cope with cold, and besides, they were tossed about dangerously in the wild wind. Their riders guided them low, among the shelter of the trees, and then flew from branch to branch, taking their bearings in the gathering dark. Will and Amma crept up in the windy moonlight to the closest point they could reach that was still out of sight of the cave mouth. It happened to be behind a heavy-leaved bush just off the path, and there he cut a window in the air. The only world he could find with the same conformation of ground was a bare, rocky place, where the moon glared down from a starry sky onto a bleached, bone-white ground, where little insects crawled and uttered their scraping, chittering sounds over a wide silence. Amma followed him through, fingers and thumbs moving furiously to protect her from the devils that must be haunting this ghastly place, and her demon adapting at once, became a lizard and scampered over the rocks with quick feet. Will saw a problem. It was simply that the brilliant moonlight on the bone-coloured rocks would shine like a lantern once he opened the window in Mrs. Coulter's cave. He'd have to open it quickly, pull Lyra through, and close it again at once. They could wake her up in this world, where it was safer. He stopped on the dazzling slope and said to Amma,
"We must be very quick and completely silent. No noise, not even a whisper."
She understood, though she was frightened. The little packet of powder was in her breast pocket. She'd checked it a dozen times, and she and her demon had rehearsed the task so often that she was sure they could do it in total darkness. They climbed up on the bone-white rocks, Will measuring the distance carefully until he estimated that they would be well inside the cave. Then he took the knife and cut the smallest possible window he could see through, no larger than the circle he could make with thumb and forefinger. He put his eye to it quickly to keep the moonlight out, and looked through. There it all was. He'd calculated well. He could see the cave mouth ahead, the rocks dark against the night sky. He could see the shape of Mrs. Coulter, asleep, with her golden demon beside her. He could even see the monkey's tail trailing negligently over the sleeping bag. Changing his angle and looking closer, he saw the rock behind which Lyra was lying. He couldn't see her, though. Was he too close? He shut that window, moved back a step or two, and opened again. She wasn't there.
"Listen,"
he said to Amma and her demon.
"The woman has moved her, and I can't see where she is. I'm going to have to go through and look around the cave to find her, and cut through as soon as I've done that. So stand back. Keep out of the way so I don't accidentally cut you when I come back. If I get stuck there for any reason, go back and wait by the other window where we came in."
"We should both go through,"
Amma said.
"Because I know how to wake her, and you don't. And I know the cave better than you do, too."
Her face was stubborn, her lips pressed together, her fists clenched. Her lizard demon acquired a ruff and raised it slowly around his neck.
"Oh, very well. But we go through quickly and in complete silence. And you do exactly what I say at once. You understand?"
She nodded and patted her pocket yet again to check the medicine. Will made a small opening, low down, looked through and enlarged it swiftly, getting through in a moment on hands and knees. Amma was right behind him, and altogether the window was open for less than 10 seconds. They crouched on the cave floor behind a large rock, with the bird-formed Balthamos beside them, their eyes taking some moments to adjust from the moon-drenched brilliance of the other world. Inside the cave it was much darker, and much more full of sound. Mostly the wind in the trees, but below that was another sound, too. It was the roar of a Zeppelin's engine, and it wasn't far away. With a knife in his right hand, Will balanced himself carefully and looked around. Amma was doing the same, and her owl-eyed demon was peering this way and that, but Lyra was not at this end of the cave. There was no doubt about it. Will raised his head over the rock and took a long, steady look down towards the entrance, where Mrs. Coulter and her demon lay deep in sleep. And then his heart sank. There lay Lyra, stretched out in the depths of her sleep, right next to Mrs. Coulter. Their outlines had merged in the darkness. No wonder he hadn't seen her. Will touched Amma's hand and pointed.
"We'll just have to do it very carefully."
Something was happening outside. The roar of the Zeppelins was now much louder than the wind in the trees, and lights were moving about too, shining down through the branches from above. The quicker they got Lyra out, the better, and that meant darting down there now before Mrs. Coulter woke up, cutting through, pulling her to safety, and closing again. He whispered that to Amma. She nodded. Then, as he was about to move, Mrs. Coulter woke up. She stirred and said something, and instantly the golden monkey sprang to his feet. Will could see his silhouette in the cave mouth, crouching, attentive. And then Mrs. Coulter herself sat up, shading her eyes against the light outside. Will's left hand was tight around Amma's wrist. Mrs. Coulter got up, fully dressed, lithe, alert, not at all as if she'd just been asleep. Perhaps she'd been awake all the time. She and the golden monkey were crouching inside the cave mouth, watching and listening, as the light from the Zeppelins swung from side to side above the treetops and the engines roared, and shouts, male voices warning or calling orders, made it clear that they should move fast, very fast. Will squeezed Amma's wrist and darted forward, watching the ground in case he stumbled, running fast and low. Then he was at Lyra's side, and she was deep asleep, pantalaimon around her neck. And then Will held up the knife and felt carefully, and a second later there would have been an opening to pull Lyra through into safety. But he looked up. He looked at Mrs. Coulter. She had turned around silently, and the glare from the sky reflected off the damp cave wall hit her face, and for a moment it wasn't her face at all. It was his own mother's face, reproaching him, and his heart quailed from sorrow. And then as he thrust with the knife, his mind left the point, and with a wrench and a crack, the knife fell in pieces to the ground. It was broken. Now he couldn't cut his way out at all. He said to Amma,
"Wake her up. Do it now."
Then he stood up, ready to fight. He'd strangle that monkey first. He was tensed to meet its leap, and he found he still had the hilt of the knife in his hand. At least he could use it to hit with. But there was no attack, either from the golden monkey or from Mrs. Coulter. She simply moved a little to let the light from outside show the pistol in her hand. In doing so, she let some of the light shine on what Amma was doing. She was sprinkling a powder on Lyra's upper lip and watching as Lyra breathed in, helping it into her nostrils by using her own demon's tail as a brush. Will heard a change in the sounds from outside. There was another note now, as well as the roar of the zeppelins. It sounded familiar, like an intrusion from his own world, and then he recognized the clatter of a helicopter. Then there was another and another, and more lights swept across the ever-moving trees outside in a brilliant green scatter of radiance. Mrs. Coulter turned briefly as the new sound came to her, but too briefly for Will to jump and seize the gun. As for the monkey demon, he glared at Will without blinking, crouched ready to spring. Lyra was moving and murmuring. Will bent down and squeezed her hand, and the other demon nudged Pantalaimon, lifting his heavy head, whispering to him. Outside there was a shout, and a man fell out of the sky, to land with a sickening crash not 5 yards from the entrance to the cave. Mrs. Coulter didn't flinch. She looked at him coolly and turned back to Will. A moment later there came a crack of rifle fire from above, and a second after that a storm of shooting broke out, and the sky was full of explosions, of the crackle of flame, of bursts of gunfire. Lyra was struggling up into consciousness, gasping, sighing, moaning, pushing herself up only to fall back weakly. And Pantalaimon was yawning, stretching, snapping at the other demon, flopping clumsily to one side as his muscles failed to act. As for Will, he was searching the cave floor with the utmost care for the pieces of the broken knife. No time to wonder how it had happened or whether it could be mended, but he was the knife-bearer and he had to gather it up safely. As he found each piece, he lifted it carefully, every nerve in his body aware of his missing fingers, and slipped it into the sheath. He could see the pieces quite easily because the metal caught the gleam from outside, 7 of them, the smallest being the point itself. He picked them all up and then turned back to try and make sense of the fight outside. Somewhere above the trees, the zeppelins were hovering and men were sliding down ropes, but the wind made it difficult for the pilots to hold the aircraft steady. Meanwhile, the first gyropters had arrived above the cliff. There was only room for them to land one at a time, and then the African riflemen had to make their way down the rock face. It was one of them who had been picked off by a lucky shot from the swaying zeppelins. By this time, both sides had landed some troops. Some had been killed between the sky and the ground. Several more were wounded and lay on the cliff or among the trees. But neither force had yet reached the cave, and still the power inside it lay with Mrs. Coulter. Will said above the noise,
"What are you going to do?"
"Hold you captive."
"What? As hostages? Why should they take any notice of that? They want to kill us all anyway."
"One force does, certainly, but I'm not sure about the other. We must hope the Africans win."
She sounded happy, and in the glare from outside, Will saw her face full of joy and life and energy.
"You broke the knife."
"No, I didn't. I wanted it whole so we could get away. You were the one who broke it."
Lyra's voice came urgently.
"Will? Is that Will?"
"Lyra."
He knelt quickly beside her. Amma was helping her sit up.
"What's happening? Where are we? Oh, Will, I had this dream."
"We're in a cave. Don't move too fast. You'll get dizzy. Just take it carefully. Find your strength. You've been asleep for days and days."
Her eyes were still heavy and she was racked by deep yawns, but she was desperate to be awake, and he helped her up, putting her arm over his shoulder and taking much of her weight. Amma watched timidly, for now that the strange girl was awake, she was nervous of her. Will breathed in the scent of Lyra's sleepy body with a happy satisfaction. She was here. She was real. They sat on a rock. Lyra held his hand and rubbed her eyes.
"What's happening, Will?"
"Amma here got some powder to wake you up."
Lyra turned to the girl, seeing her for the first time, and put her hand on Amma's shoulder in thanks.
"I got here as soon as I could, but some soldiers did too. I don't know who they are. We'll get out as soon as we can."
Outside, the noise and confusion were reaching a height. One of the gyropters had taken a fusillade from a Zeppelin's machine gun while the riflemen were jumping out on the clifftop, and it burst into flames, not only killing the crew but also preventing the remaining gyropters from landing. Another Zeppelin, meanwhile, had found a clear space further down the valley, and the crossbowmen who disembarked from it were now running up the path to reinforce those already in action. Mrs. Coulter was following as much as she could see from the cave mouth, and now she raised her pistol, supporting it with both hands, and took careful aim before firing. Will saw the flash from the muzzle, but heard nothing over the explosions and gunfire from outside. "If she does that again," he thought, "I'll rush and knock her over." And he turned to whisper that to Balthamos. But the angel was nowhere near. Instead, Will saw with dismay, he was cowering against the wall of the cave, back in his angel form, trembling and whimpering.
"Balthamos! Come on, they can't hurt you! And you have to help us! You can fight, you know that! You're not a coward, and we need you!"
But before the angel could reply, something else happened. Mrs. Coulter cried out and reached down to her ankle, and simultaneously the golden monkey snatched at something in midair with a snarl of glee. A voice, a woman's voice, but somehow minute, came from the thing in the monkey's paw.
"Tialis! Oh, Tialis!"
It was a tiny woman, no bigger than Lyra's hand, and the monkey was already pulling and pulling at one of her arms so that she cried out in pain. Amma knew he wouldn't stop till he'd torn it off, but Will leapt forward as he saw the pistol fall from Mrs. Coulter's hand. And he caught the gun. But then Mrs. Coulter fell still, and Will became aware of a strange stalemate. The golden monkey and Mrs. Coulter were both utterly motionless. Her face was distorted with pain and fury, but she dared not move, because standing on her shoulder was a tiny man with his heel pressed against her neck, his hands entwined in her hair. And Will, through his astonishment, saw on that heel a glistening horny spur and knew what had caused her to cry out a moment before. He must have stung her ankle. But the little man couldn't hurt Mrs. Coulter any more because of the danger his partner was in at the hands of the monkey. And the monkey couldn't harm her in case the little man dug his poison spur into Mrs. Coulter's jugular vein. None of them could move. Breathing deeply and swallowing hard to govern the pain, Mrs. Coulter turned her tear-dashed eyes to Will.
"So, Master Will, what do you think we should do now?"
Chapter 13. Tialis and Salmakia.
"Frowning, frowning night, o'er this desert bright, let thy moon arise while I close my eyes." William Blake.
Holding the heavy gun, Will swept his hand sideways and knocked the golden monkey off his perch, stunning him so that Mrs. Coulter groaned aloud and the monkey's paw relaxed enough to let the tiny woman struggle free. In a moment she leapt up to the rocks, and the man sprang away from Mrs. Coulter, both of them moving as quickly as grasshoppers. The three children had no time to be astonished. The man was concerned. He felt his companion's shoulder and arm tenderly and embraced her swiftly before calling to Will.
"You, boy, have you got the knife?"
"Of course I have,"
said Will. If they didn't know it was broken, he wasn't going to tell them.
"You and the girl will have to follow us. Who is the other child?"
"Amma, from the village."
"Tell her to return there. Move now, before the Swiss come."
Will didn't hesitate. Whatever these two intended, he and Lyra could still get away through the window he'd opened behind the bush on the path below. So he helped her up and watched curiously as the two small figures leapt on... what? Birds? No, dragonflies, as large as seagulls, which had been waiting in the darkness. Then they darted forward to the cave mouth where Mrs. Coulter lay. She was half stunned with pain and drowsy from the Chevalier's sting, but she reached up as they went past her and cried,
"Lyra! Lyra, my daughter! My dear one, Lyra! Don't go! Don't go!"
Lyra looked down at her, anguished, but then she stepped over her mother's body and loosened Mrs. Coulter's feeble clutch from her ankle. The woman was sobbing now. Will saw the tears glistening on her cheeks. Crouching just beside the cave mouth, the three children waited until there was a brief pause in the shooting, and then followed the dragonflies as they darted down the path. The light had changed. As well as the cold anbaric gleam from the Zeppelin's floodlights, there was the leaping orange of flames. Will looked back once. In the glare, Mrs. Coulter's face was a mask of tragic passion, and her demon clung piteously to her as she knelt and held out her arms, crying,
"Lyra! Lyra, my love! My heart's treasure! My little child! My only one!"
Oh, Lyra! Lyra, don't go! Don't leave me! My darling daughter, you're tearing my heart!
And a great and furious sob shook Lyra herself, for after all, Mrs. Coulter was the only mother she would ever have, and Will saw a cascade of tears run down the girl's cheeks. But he had to be ruthless. He pulled at Lyra's hand, and as the dragonfly rider darted close to his head, urging them to hurry, he led her at a crouching run down the path and away from the cave. In Will's left hand, bleeding again from the blow he'd landed on the monkey, was Mrs. Coulter's pistol.
"Make for the top of the cliff,"
said the dragonfly rider,
"and give yourself up to the Africans. They're your best hope."
Mindful of those sharp spurs, Will said nothing, though he hadn't the least intention of obeying. There was only one place he was making for, and that was the window behind the bush. So he kept his head low and ran fast, and Lyra and Amma ran behind him.
"Halt!"
There was a man, three men, blocking the path ahead, uniformed. White men with crossbows and snarling wolf-dog demons, the Swiss Guard.
"Yorick!"
cried Will at once.
"Yorick Birnison!"
He could hear the bear crashing and snarling not far away, and hear the screams and cries of the soldiers unlucky enough to meet him. But someone else came from nowhere to help them. Balthamos, in a blur of desperation, hurled himself between the children and the soldiers. The men fell back, amazed, as this apparition shimmered into being in front of them. But they were trained warriors, and a moment later their demons leapt at the angel, savage teeth flashing white in the gloom, and Balthamos flinched. He cried out in fear and shame, and shrank back. Then he sprang upwards, beating his wings hard. Will watched in dismay as the figure of his guide and friend soared up to vanish out of sight among the treetops. Lyra was following it all with still dazed eyes. It had taken no more than 2 or 3 seconds, but it was enough for the Swiss to regroup, and now their leader was raising his crossbow, and Will had no choice. He swung up the pistol and clamped his right hand to the butt and pulled the trigger, and the blast shook his bones, but the bullet found the man's heart. The soldier fell back as if he'd been kicked by a horse. Simultaneously, the two little spies launched themselves at the other two, leaping from the dragonflies at their victims before Will could blink. The woman found a neck, the man a wrist, and each made a quick backward stab with a heel. A choking, anguished gasp, and the two Swiss died, their demons vanishing in mid-howl. Will leapt over the bodies, and Lyra went with him, running hard and fast with Pantalaimon racing wildcat formed at their heels. "Where's Amma?" Will thought, and he saw her in the same moment dodging down a different path. "Now she'll be safe," he thought, and a second later he saw the pale gleam of the window deep behind the bushes. He seized Lyra's arm and pulled her towards it. Their faces were scratched, their clothes were snagged, their ankles twisted on roots and rocks, but they found the window and tumbled through into the other world, onto the bone-white rocks under the glaring moon, where only the scraping of the insects broke the immense silence. And the first thing Will did was to hold his stomach and retch, heaving and heaving with a mortal horror. That was two men now that he'd killed, not to mention the youth in the Tower of the Angels. Will did not want this. His body revolted at what his instinct had made him do, and the result was a dry, sour, agonizing spell of kneeling and vomiting until his stomach and his heart were empty. Lyra watched helpless nearby, nursing Pan, rocking him against her breast. Will finally recovered a little and looked around, and at once he saw that they weren't alone in this world because the little spies were there too, with their packs laid on the ground nearby. Their dragonflies were skimming over the rocks, snapping up moths. A man was massaging the shoulder of the woman, and both of them looked at the children sternly. Their eyes were so bright and their features so distinct that there was no doubt about their feelings, and Will knew they were a formidable pair, whoever they were. He said to Lyra,
"The alethiometer's in my rucksack. There."
"Oh, Will, I did so hope you'd find it. Whatever happened? Did you find your father? Oh, and my dream, Will. It's too much to believe what we've got to do. Oh, I didn't even think of it. And it's safe. You brought it all this way safe for me."
The words tumbled out of her so urgently that even she didn't expect answers. She turned the alethiometer over and over, her fingers stroking the heavy gold and the smooth crystal and the knurled wheels they knew so well. Will thought, "It'll tell us how to mend the knife." But he said first,
"Are you all right? Are you hungry or thirsty?"
"I don't know. Yeah, but not too much. Anyway..."
"We should move away from this window, just in case they find it and come through."
Yes, that's true,
she said, and they moved up the slope, Will carrying his rucksack and Lyra happily carrying the little bag she kept the alethiometer in. Out of the corner of his eye, Will saw the two small spies following, but they kept their distance and made no threat. Over the brow of the rise there was a ledge of rock that offered a narrow shelter, and they sat beneath it, having carefully checked it for snakes, and shared some dried fruit and some water from Will's bottle.
The knife's broken. I don't know how it happened. Mrs. Coulter did something, or said something, and I thought of my mother, and that made the knife twist, or catch, or... I don't know what happened. But we're stuck till we can get it mended. I didn't want those two little people to know, because while they think I can still use it, I've got the upper hand. I thought you could ask the alethiometer, maybe, and...
Yeah, I will.
She had the golden instrument out in a moment, and moved into the moonlight so she could see the dial clearly. Looping back the hair behind her ears, just as Will had seen her mother do, she began to turn the wheels in the old familiar way, and Pantalaimon, mouse-formed now, sat on her knee. She had hardly started before she gave a little gasp of excitement, and she looked up at Will with shining eyes as the needle swung. But it hadn't finished yet, and she looked back, frowning, until the instrument fell still. She put it away, saying,
Yorick, is he nearby, Will? I thought I heard you call him, but then I thought I was just wishing. Is he really?
Yes. Could he mend the knife? Is that what the alethiometer said?
Oh, he can do anything with metal, Will. Not only armour, he can make little delicate things as well.
She told him about the small tin box Yorick had made for her to shut the spy fly in.
But where is he?
Close by. He would have come when I called, but obviously he was fighting. And Balthamus. Oh, he must have been so frightened.
Who?
He explained briefly, feeling his cheeks warm with the shame that the angel must be feeling.
But I'll tell you more about him later. It's so strange. He told me so many things, and I think I understand them too.
He ran his hands through his hair and rubbed his eyes.
You got to tell me everything. Everything you did since she caught me. Oh, Will, you ain't still bleeding. Your poor hand.
No. My father cured it. I just opened it up when I hit the golden monkey. But it's better now. He gave me some ointment that he'd made.
You found your father?
That's right. On the mountain, that night.
He let her clean his wound and put on some fresh ointment from the little horn box while he told her some of what had happened. The fight with the stranger. The revelation that came to them both a second before the witch's arrow struck home. His meeting with the angels. His journey to the cave. And his meeting with Yorick.
All that happening, and I was asleep. Do you know, I think she was kind to me, Will. I think she was. I don't think she ever wanted to hurt me. She did such bad things, but...
She rubbed her eyes.
Oh, but my dream, Will. I can't tell you how strange it was. It was like when I read the alethiometer. All that clearness and understanding going so deep, you can't see the bottom, but clear all the way down. It was... Remember I told you about my friend Roger, and how the gobblers caught him, and I tried to rescue him, and it went wrong, and Lord Asriel killed him. Well, I saw him. In my dream, I saw him again. Only he was dead. He was a ghost, and he was, like, beckoning to me, calling to me. Only I couldn't hear. He didn't want me to be dead. It wasn't that. He wanted to speak to me. And it was me that took him there, to Svalbard, where he got killed. It was my fault he was dead. And I thought back to when we used to play in Jordan College, Roger and me, on the roof, all through the town, in the markets and by the river and down the clay beds, me and Roger and all the others. And I went to Bolvanger to fetch him safe home. Only I made it worse. And if I don't say sorry, it'll all be no good, just a huge waste of time. I got to do that, you see, Will. I got to go down into the land of the dead and find him, and say sorry. I don't care what happens after that. Then we can... I can... Well, it doesn't matter after that.
This place where the dead are, is it a world like this one, like mine, or yours, or any of the others? Is it a world I could get to with the knife?
She looked at him, struck by the idea.
You could ask. Do it now. Ask where it is and how we get there.
She bent over the alethiometer and her fingers moved swiftly. A minute later, she had the answer.
Yes, but it's a strange place, Will. So strange. Could we really do that? Could we really go to the land of the dead? But what part of us does that? Because demons fade away when we die. I've seen them. And our bodies, well, they just stay in the grave and decay, don't they?
Then there must be a third part. A different part.
You know, I think that must be true. Because I can think about my body and I can think about my demon. So there must be another part to do the thinking.
Yes. And that's the ghost.
Lyra's eyes blazed.
Maybe we could get Roger's ghost out. Maybe we could rescue him.
Maybe. We could try.
Yeah, we'll do it. We'll go together. That's exactly what we'll do.
But if they didn't get the knife mended, Will thought, they'd be able to do nothing at all. As soon as his head cleared and his stomach felt calmer, he sat up and called to the little spies. They were busy with some minute apparatus nearby.
Who are you? And whose side are you on?
The man finished what he was doing and shut a wooden box like a violin case no longer than a walnut. The woman spoke first.
We are Galavespian. I am the Lady Salmakia, and my companion is the Chevalier Tialis. We are spies for Lord Asriel.
She was standing on a rock 3 or 4 paces away from Will and Lyra, distinct and brilliant in the moonlight. Her little voice was perfectly clear and low, her expression confident. She wore a loose skirt of some silver material and a sleeveless top of green, and her spurred feet were bare like the man's. His costume was similarly coloured, but his sleeves were long and his wide trousers reached to mid-calf. Both of them looked strong, capable, ruthless and proud.
What world do you come from? I never seen people like you before.
Our world has the same problems as yours, said Tialis. We are outlaws. Our leader, Lord Roke, heard of Lord Asriel's revolt and pledged our support.
And what did you want to do with me?
To take you to your father,
said the Lady Salmakia.
Lord Asriel sent a force under King Ogunwe to rescue you and the boy and bring you both to his fortress. We are here to help.
Ah, but suppose I don't want to go to my father? Suppose I don't trust him?
I'm sorry to hear that, but those are our orders, to take you to him.
Lyra couldn't help it. She laughed out loud at the notion of these tiny people making her do anything. But it was a mistake. Moving suddenly, the woman seized Pantalaimon, and holding his mouse body in a fierce grip, she touched the tip of a spur to his leg. Lyra gasped. It was like the shock when the men at Bolvanger had seized him. No one should touch someone else's demon. It was a violation. But then she saw that Will had swept up the man in his right hand, holding him tightly around the leg so he couldn't use his spurs, and was holding him high.
Stalemate again. Put the Chevalier down, boy.
Let go of Lyra's demon first. I'm not in the mood to argue.
Lyra saw with a cold thrill that Will was perfectly ready to dash the Galavespian's head against the rock, and both little people knew it. Salmakia lifted her foot away from Pantalaimon's leg, and at once he fought free of her grasp and changed into a wildcat, hissing ferociously, fur on end, tail lashing. His bared teeth were a hand's breadth from the lady's face, and she gazed at him with perfect composure. After a moment he turned and fled to Lyra's breast, ermine-shaped, and Will carefully placed Tialis back on the rock beside his partner.
You should show some respect,
the Chevalier said to Lyra.
You are a thoughtless, insolent child, and several brave men have died this evening in order to make you safe. You'd do better to act politely.
Yes, I'm sorry, I will. Honest.
As for you...
As for me, I'm not going to be spoken to like that, so don't try. Respect goes two ways. Now listen carefully. You are not in charge here. We are. If you want to stay and help, then you do as we say. Otherwise, go back to Lord Asriel now. There's no arguing about it.
Lyra could see the pair of them bristling, but Tialis was looking at Will's hand, which was on the sheath at his belt, and she knew he was thinking that while Will had the knife, he was stronger than they were. At all costs, they mustn't know it was broken then.
Very well. We shall help you, because that's the task we've been given. But you must let us know what you intend to do.
That's fair. I'll tell you. We're going back into Lyra's world as soon as we've rested, and we're going to find a friend of ours, a bear. He's not far away.
The bear with the armor? Very well. We saw him fight. We'll help you do that. But then you must come with us to Lord Asriel.
Yes,
said Lyra, lying earnestly.
Oh, yes, we'll do that then, all right.
Pantalaimon was calmer now and curious, so she let him climb to her shoulder and change. He became a dragonfly, as big as the two that were skimming through the air as they spoke, and darted up to join them.
That poison,
Lyra said, turning back to the Gallivespians.
In your spurs, I mean. Is it deadly? Because you stung my mother, Mrs. Coulter, didn't you? Will she die?
It was only a light sting,
said Tialis.
A full dose would have killed her, yes, but a small scratch will make her weak and drowsy for half a day or so.
And full of maddening pain, he knew, but he didn't tell her that.
I need to talk to Lyra in private. We're just going to move away for a minute.
With that knife, you can cut through from one world to another, isn't that so?
Don't you trust me?
No.
All right, I'll leave it here then. If I haven't got it, I can't use it.
He unbuckled the sheath and laid it on the rock, and then he and Lyra walked away and sat where they could see the Gallivespians. Tialis was looking closely at the knife handle, but he wasn't touching it.
We'll just have to put up with them. As soon as the knife's mended, we'll escape.
They're so quick, Will. And they wouldn't care. They'd kill you.
I just hope Yorick can mend it. I hadn't realized how much we need it.
He will.
She was watching Pantalaimon as he skimmed and darted through the air, snapping up tiny moths like the other dragonflies. He couldn't go as far as they could, but he was just as fast, and even more brightly patterned. She raised her hand and he settled on it, his long, transparent wings vibrating.
Do you think we can trust them while we sleep?
Will said.
Yes, they're fierce, but I think they're honest.
They went back to the rock, and Will said to the Gallivespians,
I'm going to sleep now. We'll move on in the morning.
The Chevalier nodded, and Will curled up at once and fell asleep. Lyra sat down beside him with Pantalaimon cat-formed and warm in her lap. How lucky Will was that she was awake now to look after him. He was truly fearless, and she admired that beyond measure. But he wasn't good at lying and betraying and cheating, which all came to her as naturally as breathing. When she thought of that, she felt warm and virtuous, because she did it for Will, never for herself. She had intended to look at the alethiometer again, but to her deep surprise she found herself as weary as if she'd been awake all that time instead of unconscious. And she lay down close by and closed her eyes, just for a brief nap, as she assured herself before she fell asleep. Chapter 14. Know What It Is.
Labor without joy is base. Labor without sorrow is base. Sorrow without labor is base. Joy without labor is base. John Ruskin.
Will and Lyra slept through the night and woke up when the sun struck their eyelids. They actually awoke within seconds of each other with the same thought, but when they looked around, the Chevalier Tialis was calmly on guard close by.
The force of the consistorial court has retreated. Mrs. Coulter is in the hands of King Ogunwe, and on her way to Lord Asriel.
How do you know?
Said Will, sitting up stiffly.
Have you been back through the window?
No. We talk through the lodestone resonator. I reported our conversation,
Tialis said to Lyra,
to my commander, Lord Roke, and he has agreed that we should go with you to the bear, and that once you have seen him, you will come with us. So, we are allies, and we shall help you as much as we can.
Good. Then let's eat together. Do you eat our food?
Thank you, yes,
said the lady. Will took out his last few dried peaches and the stale flat loaf of rye bread, which was all he had left, and shared it among them, though of course the spies did not take much.
As for water, there doesn't seem to be any around here on this world. We'll have to wait till we go back through before we can have a drink.
Then we better do that soon,
said Lyra. First, though, she took out the alethiometer and asked if there was still any danger in the valley. No, came the answer. All the soldiers have gone, and the villagers are in their homes. So they prepared to leave. The window looked strange in the dazzling air of the desert, giving on to the deep shaded bush, a square of thick green vegetation hanging in the air like a painting. The Gallivespians wanted to look at it, and were astounded to see how it was just not there from the back, and how it only sprang into being when you came round from the side.
I'll have to close it once we're through, Will said.
Lyra tried to pinch the edges together after they went through, but her fingers couldn't find it at all. Nor could the spies, despite the fineness of their hands. Only Will could feel exactly where the edges were, and he did it cleanly and quickly.
How many worlds can you enter with the knife?
As many as there are. No one would ever have time to find out.
He swung his rucksack up and led the way along the forest path. The dragonflies relished the fresh, moist air and darted like needles through the shafts of sunlight. The movement of the trees above was less violent, and the air was cool and tranquil, so it was all the more shocking to see the twisted wreckage of a gyropter suspended among the branches, with the body of its African pilot tangled in his seatbelt, half out of the door, and to find the charred remains of the Zeppelin a little farther up, soot-black strips of cloth, blackened struts and pipework, broken glass, and then the bodies. Three men burned to cinders, their limbs contorted and drawn up as if they were still threatening to fight. And they were only the ones who had fallen near the path. There were other bodies and more wreckage on the cliff above and among the trees further down. Shocked and silenced, the two children moved through the carnage, while the spies on their dragonflies looked around more coolly, accustomed to battle, noting how it had gone and who had lost most. When they reached the top of the valley, where the trees thinned out and the rainbow waterfalls began, they stopped to drink deeply of the ice-cold water.
I hope that little girl's all right. We'd never have got you away if she hadn't woken you up. She went to a holy man to get that powder specially.
She is all right, 'cause I asked the alethiometer last night. She thinks we're devils, though. She's afraid of us. She probably wishes she'd never got mixed up in it. But she's safe all right.
They climbed up beside the waterfalls and refilled Will's canteen before striking off across the plateau towards the ridge where the alethiometer told Lyra that Yorick had gone. And then there came a day of long, hard walking. No trouble for Will, but a torment to Lyra, whose limbs were weakened and softened after her long sleep. But she would sooner have her tongue torn out than confess how bad she felt. Limping, tight-lipped, trembling, she kept pace with Will and said nothing. Only when they sat down at noon did she allow herself so much as a whimper, and then only when Will had gone apart to relieve himself. The Lady Salmakia said,
"Rest. There is no disgrace in being weary."
"But I don't want to let Will down. I don't want him to think I'm weak and holding him back."
"That's the last thing he thinks."
"You don't know. You don't know him any more than you know me."
"I know impertinence when I hear it. Do as I tell you now and rest. Save your energy for the walking."
Lyra felt mutinous, but the lady's glittering spurs were very clear in the sunlight, so she said nothing. The lady's companion, the Chevalier, was opening the case of the lodestone resonator, and, curiosity overcoming resentment, Lyra watched to see what he did. The instrument looked like a short length of pencil made of dull grey-black stone, resting on a stand of wood, and the Chevalier swept a tiny bow like a violinist's across the end, while he pressed his fingers at various points along the surface. The places weren't marked, so he seemed to be touching it at random, but from the intensity of his expression and the certain fluency of his movements, Lyra knew it was as skillful and demanding a process as her own reading of the alethiometer. After several minutes, the spy put the bow away and took up a pair of headphones, the earpieces no larger than Lyra's little fingernail, and wrapped one end of the wire tightly around a peg in the end of the stone, leading the rest along to another peg at the other end, and wrapping it around that. By manipulating the two pegs and the tension on the wire between them, he could obviously hear a response to his own message.
"How does that work?"
she said when he'd finished. Tialis looked at her as if to judge whether she was genuinely interested, and then said,
"Your scientists, what do you call them, experimental theologians, would know of something called quantum entanglement. It means that two particles can exist that only have properties in common, so that whatever happens to one happens to the other at the same moment, no matter how far apart they are. Well, in our world, there is a way of taking a common lodestone and entangling all its particles and then splitting it in two so that both parts resonate together. The counterpart to this is with Lord Roke, our commander. When I play on this one with my bow, the other one reproduces the sounds exactly. And so we communicate."
He put everything away and said something to the lady. She joined him and they went a little apart, talking too quietly for Lyra to hear, though Pantalaimon became an owl and turned his great ears in their direction. Presently Will came back and then they moved on, more slowly as the day went by and the track got steeper and the snow line nearer. They rested once more at the head of a rocky valley, because even Will could tell that Lyra was nearly finished. She was limping badly and her face was grey.
"Let me see your feet,"
he said to her.
"Because if they're blistered, I'll put some ointment on."
They were, badly, and she let him rub in the blood moss salve, closing her eyes and gritting her teeth. Meanwhile, the Chevalier was busy, and after a few minutes he put his lodestone away and said,
"I have told Lord Roke of our position, and they are sending a gyropter to bring us away as soon as you have spoken to your friend."
Will nodded. Lyra took no notice. Presently she sat up wearily and pulled on her socks and shoes, and they set off once more. Another hour, and most of the valley was in shadow, and Will was wondering whether they would find any shelter before night fell. But then Lyra gave a cry of relief and joy.
"Yorick! Yorick!"
She had seen him before Will had. The Bear King was some way off still, his white coat indistinct against a patch of snow, but when Lyra's voice echoed out he turned his head, raised it to sniff, and bounded down the mountainside towards them. Ignoring Will, he let Lyra clasp his neck and bury her face in his fur, growling so deep that Will felt it through his feet. But Lyra felt it as pleasure and forgot her blisters and her weariness in a moment.
"Oh, Yorick, my dear, I'm so glad to see you. I never thought I'd ever see you again, after that time on Svalbard. And all the things that have happened. Is Mr. Scoresby safe? How's your kingdom? Are you all alone here?"
The little spies had vanished. At all events, there seemed to be only the three of them now on the darkening mountainside, the boy and the girl and the great white bear. As if she had never wanted to be anywhere else, Lyra climbed up as Yorick offered his back, and rode proud and happy as her dear friend carried her up the last stretch of the way to his cave. Will, preoccupied, didn't listen as Lyra talked to Yorick, though he did hear a cry of dismay at one point and heard her say,
"Mr. Scoresby! Oh, no! Oh, it's too cruel! Really dead. You're sure, Yorick?"
"The witch told me he set out to find the man called Grumman."
Will listened more closely now, for Baruch and Balthamos had told him some of this.
"What happened? Who killed him?"
"He died fighting. He kept a whole company of Muscovites at bay while the man escaped. I found his body. He died bravely. I shall avenge him."
Lyra was weeping freely, and Will didn't know what to say, for it was his father whom this unknown man had died to save. And Lyra and the bear had both known and loved Lee Scoresby, and he had not. Soon Yorick turned aside and made for the entrance to a cave, very dark against the snow. Will didn't know where the spies were, but he was perfectly sure they were nearby. He wanted to speak quietly to Lyra, but not till he could see the Gallivespians and know he wasn't being overheard. He laid his rucksack in the cave mouth and sat down wearily. Behind him the bear was kindling a fire, and Lyra watched, curious despite her sorrow. Yorick held a small rock of some sort of ironstone in his left forepaw and struck it no more than three or four times on a similar one on the floor. Each time a scatter of sparks burst out and went exactly where Yorick directed them, into a heap of shredded twigs and dried grass. Very soon that was ablaze, and Yorick calmly placed one log and then another and another until the fire was burning strongly. The children welcomed it, because the air was very cold now. And then came something even better, a haunch of something that might have been goat. Yorick ate his meat raw, of course, but he spitted its joint on a sharp stick and laid it to roast across the fire for the two of them.
"Is it easy, hunting up in these mountains, Yorick?"
"No, my people can't live here. I was wrong, but luckily so, since I found you. What are your plans now?"
Will looked around the cave. They were sitting close to the fire, and the firelight threw warm yellows and oranges on the Bear King's fur. Will could see no sign of the spies, but there was nothing for it. He had to ask.
"King Yorick, my knife is broken."
Then he looked past the bear and said,
"No, wait."
He was pointing at the wall.
"If you're listening, come out and do it honestly. Don't spy on us."
Lyra and Yorick Birnison turned to see who he was talking to. The little man came out of the shadow and stood calmly in the light on a ledge higher than the children's heads. Yorick growled.
"You haven't asked Yorick Birnison for permission to enter his cave. And he is a king and you're just a spy. You should show more respect."
Lyra loved hearing that. She looked at Will with pleasure and saw him fierce and contemptuous. But the Chevalier's expression as he looked at Will was displeased.
We have been truthful with you. It was dishonourable to deceive us.
Will stood up. His demon, Lyra thought, would have the form of a tigress, and she shrank back from the anger she imagined the great animal to show.
If we deceived you, it was necessary. Would you have agreed to come here if you knew the knife was broken? Of course you wouldn't. You'd have used your venom to make us unconscious, and then you'd have called for help and had us kidnapped and taken to Lord Asriel. So we had to trick you, Tialis, and you'll just have to put up with it.
Who is this?
Spies, sent by Lord Asriel. They helped us escape yesterday, but if they're on our side, they shouldn't hide and eavesdrop on us. And if they do, they're the last people who should talk about dishonour.
The spy's glare was so ferocious that he looked ready to take on Yorick himself, never mind the unarmed Will. But Tialis was in the wrong, and he knew it. All he could do was bow and apologize.
Your Majesty,
he said to Yorick, who growled at once.